You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Maria Zakharova, who is an activist and a public lecturer based in Odessa, Ukraine. She has been a strong supporter of the Council of Mothers of May 2nd, which represents relatives of the scores of progressives murdered at Odessa's House of Trade Unions by a right-wing mob on May 2nd, 2014, just a few months after the coup that overthrew the democratically elected president of Ukraine. Ever since the massacre, Zakharova has been promoting the demand of the Council of Mothers for an international investigation into who was responsible for the murders, addressing this issue at meetings, conferences, rallies across Europe and in the United States. Zakharova is a graduate of Odessa National Technic University with a degree in computer engineering. She holds a doctorate in social psychology and is currently pursuing studies in the field of scientific community. Maria Zakharova, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
I'm very glad to be here on your radio station. Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you. Maria Zakharova, I should clarify that there is another Maria Zakharova who is the Director of Information for the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. That's not you, right?
No, it's not me. I did not know before about this woman. This is just the name, like my...
just happens to have the same name. So what can you tell us? Remind people what happened 5 years ago in Ukraine, and what should we know about the history of Ukraine leading up to 5 years ago so that we can understand it?
Okay. I think anybody know that Ukraine is the country of Eastern Europe that was part of the Soviet Union before it collapsed. It proclaimed independence in 1991. And it is geographically is the largest country in Europe, which has 2,600 kilometers of common border with Russia. After proclaiming independence, Ukraine declared itself a neutral state. And it was very hard period in our country of the late 19th and early 2000s in Ukraine. Multi-level intervention by West at all spheres of economic, political, and cultural and social life. It's important to say the interests of West in Eastern Europe are quite understandable.
So after the difficult period of the 1990s, yes, and early 2000s, then what happened?
Then in 2000, for the first time in NATO history, the annual meeting of the main political body of NATO, the North Atlantic Council, was held outside of NATO member countries in Kyiv, in the capital of Ukraine. And on April 2004, Ukraine's parliament passed a law on free access of NATO forces to the territory of Ukraine.
So in the year 2000, NATO met in Ukraine, and Ukraine passed a law that NATO forces could simply access Ukraine. But Ukraine,
yes,
was not and still is not a member of NATO, right?
Still not. Next was the period when the head of government, Viktor Yanukovych, made a statement that Ukraine was not ready to join NATO. He argued that only a small part of Ukrainian society, just about 20% of population, support Ukrainians joining of NATO. Therefore, it was too early to talk about that. And after when Viktor Yanukovych came to power, he became a president of Ukraine in 2010. The questions of Ukraine's entry into NATO were frozen. And after that, United States and NATO took a very skeptically. And the United States showed readiness to support the change in the position of the Ukrainian government. It is now becoming clear why the United States made so much effort to change the course in Ukraine in subsequent years. And it is clear why they want to make a coup in our country.
Why? Why does the United States want to do that?
They want to put Ukraine into NATO. And when President Yanukovych, he was pro-Russian president, and he don't want to put Ukraine into NATO. That's why United States want to change the government, change the course, political course in Ukraine, into pro-American.
And what steps, Maria Zakharova, did the United States take to interfere in Ukrainian government?
This is a lot of steps, because since the 90s and early 2000s, United States the corrupt of Ukrainian elite. First of all, giving expensive loans given by IMF. These loans are so huge, and the Eastern interests of them is so great that many future generations of Ukrainians will have to pay for them. The next is financing NGOs in Ukraine. There was a lot of American foundations, for example, Soros Foundation and the National Endowment for Democracy. They are paying paying a lot of money to our NGOs. They want to train our opposition. And they training our journalists how to make informational war. They financing and new media, and they making anything to make a big opposition in our country that will bring Ukraine to another political way.
And so what happened 5 years ago, and what is the investigation that you are still demanding?
5 years ago, a corrupt pro-Russian president was replaced by a core, pro-Western president as a result of a core. I'm sorry. And it was a big tragedy in our city, in Odessa, on May 2nd, when the opponents of the coup were burned alive. The civil war started in our country and has been going on for 5 years.
And what happened at the House of Trade Unions?
It was a big tragedy because it was peaceful demonstration of a peaceful camp of the people who not support. They want to make civilization in our country. They were put to the House of Trade Unions, and this house was burned by Molotov cocktails. And the people who were tried to save their lives, they were killed, and they were beaten by pro-Maidan radicals. And it was at least 48 people burned and died.
And why are you unable to get the sort of investigation you're looking for?
Nobody take care about this, because anybody who wants this investigation, they are followed by our secret service. And a lot of political prisoners in Odessa and in Ukraine, and anybody who is interested in this topic, the government tried to shut down and to close the people. Nobody wants this investigation. Nobody in government support to make it.
We're speaking with Maria Zakharova, who is an activist and public lecturer from Odessa, Ukraine. Maria, you're in Washington, D.C. for events opposing NATO's 70th anniversary celebration, correct?
Yes.
I should say people can find out about some of these events at no2nato.org. When I talk to people about the events we're doing and about opposing NATO, Maria, I'm often told that we need NATO to protect the world from Russia, that Russia is seizing Ukraine, Russia is taking over Ukraine, Russia is threatening the peaceful nations of the world. How do you respond to that idea?
I think NATO was established as an organization who have to defend West from Soviet Union. It was in 1949, but still that we are not now. We are not NATO. It seems to me that now NATO became a tool to size countries in favor of the U.S. national interest. 1999, bombing of Yugoslavia. It was the first time in the history when the United States showed that they are not supposed they show make clear to the world that the period of international law was over, because they show that they can now it became possible to seize territories on the basis of national interests by demonstrating and using force. Now it's very important, because after our coup and after this 5 year of civil war in Ukraine. Now we are we are on verge at achieving the main U.S. strategic goal, because the strategic course for obtaining full membership in NATO is now enshrined in our constitution of Ukraine. It was happened this year in February. In February 21, it entered into force. That's why I think that all it was done to put NATO to the long border with Russia, so that I don't think that Russia is a danger for Ukraine. I think the real danger is the United States.
So, Maria Zakharova, there is now another election in Ukraine. Do you expect this to make any difference in terms of Ukraine's relationship to NATO and the West, or to Russia?
Yes, yesterday it was elections in Ukraine, and there are two candidates who pass the first step of elections and come to the second tour. That will be at the April 21st. Now it's our President Poroshenko come to the second tour, and the new candidate Zelensky. He is a showman, and it was an unexpected result, because a lot of people voted for him just because he is a new person in politics, and he never was in politics, and nobody know what to expect from this situation. And it seems to me that he was elected because he is new.
So it's,
and the people want to see new opportunities, something new, not the former curse of Ukraine that now exists.
I have to say it worries me, because in the United States, this is a man who plays the president on a television show in an election to be an actual president. The United States has elected a man who was never in politics, who played a big, important guy on a television show, and people hoped for something new and different, and they got the disaster that is Donald Trump. So I'm a little bit worried about Ukraine.
Donald Trump is not just a showman; he is a big businessman, and Zelensky is just showman.
Is he a pro-Western showman or a pro-Russian showman? Or
he's not pro-Western, not pro-Russian. He's an actor.
He's an actor.
Yes, I don't know what to wait from this, because he can show. We know that Ukrainian oligarch. His name is Igor Kolomoisky. He's standing behind Zelensky, and it seems to me he will manage him.
Well, we will see what happens. As you're in Washington, D.C. for the No to NATO, Yes to Peace events, are you speaking with people from the United States, and are they asking you questions about Ukraine? I know that a lot of people in the United States tell me that Russia seizing Crimea is the biggest threat to peace in the world. How do you respond to that idea?
I think that Russia is the first. It was a referendum. It's right word in English. A referendum.
Yes, a referendum. The people of Crimea voted.
The people voted for this. And I know Crimea very well, because I often was there, often visited Crimea. And I know that maybe 90% of Crimea people are Russian. That's why it's, I think that they wanted to come to Russia at first. And the second one is that I think that Russia don't has interest not to. They cannot allow NATO bases into Crimea. It's very understandable. It's like Russia put military bases, for example, to Mexico or very close to the United States.
Right.
It seems to me the United States don't support this, you know.
It does not, no. I guess there are Russian troops now in Venezuela. How does the United States' action toward Venezuela in recent months compare to what you've seen the United States do in Ukraine?
It seems to me, I see the situation is very similar. And we know that United States' interest in Venezuela is oil, and they want to control this country. And I think that it is two methods that use United States and the world to make control under the country. The first is coup, like in Ukraine, or like in other countries, we know, or this is military invasion. So I think that we can expect one of these two steps. And I think that what to wait of Venezuela people, I think that situation closer, more similarities with Syria or Libya than with Ukraine. That's why I think it depends on how quickly oligarchs and political elites of United States need to control this region. If they want to do it fast, then it can be military invasion, or like in Syria, or like in Libya. Or if they have time and want to do it slowly, then we can expect destabilization and chaotization and training opposition, forming this opposition and forming new media and a long way that lead to coup. But to my mind, the first variant is more expectable than second.
I hope not.
I hope not. I hope that this NATO conference and NATO march and all activities of peaceful people, they can help, because the people don't want new war.
I certainly hope so, too. Again, people can go to no2nato.org and find information and videos and events to take part in. With just a few minutes left, Maria Zakharova, it seems that NATO's biggest focus beyond anything in South America or Georgia or other countries is still Ukraine. The NATO website has some of its articles in English, French, and Ukrainian. They seem to be very focused on reaching people in Ukraine. What can people in the United States or anywhere else do to help the people of Ukraine, and in particular to help the Council of Mothers of May 2nd with your demands for accountability?
Well, you know that this year is the first fifth anniversary of the tragedy of May 2nd in Odessa. And we call upon all people in the world who fight for the peace and justice to join us in commemoration of this massacre. And we ask, please come out to demonstrations in your cities and in your states to demand investigation of this tragedy and justice for the victims.
Very good. May 2nd.
May 2nd, yes.
We will have information at notonato.org and worldbeyondwar.org. Maria Zakharova, thank you for everything you're doing and for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you very much for calling me. It's a great honor to me to speak with you here in your show. Thank you very much.
NATO is coming to Washington, D.C. to mark 70 years since its creation on April 4, 1949. NATO is the largest military alliance in the world, with the largest military spending, roughly three-quarters of the world's total, and nuclear stockpiles. While claiming to, quote, preserve peace, NATO has violated international law and bombed Bosnia and Herzegovina, Kosovo, Serbia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Libya. NATO has exacerbated tensions with Russia and increased the risk of nuclear apocalypse. The notion that supporting NATO is a way to cooperate with the world ignores superior, non-deadly ways to cooperate with the world. War is a leading contributor to the growing global refugee and climate crises, the basis for the militarization of the police, a top cause of the erosion of civil liberties, and a catalyst for racism and bigotry. We are calling for the abolition of NATO, the promotion of peace, the redirection of resources to human and environmental needs, and the demilitarization of our cultures. Instead of celebrating NATO's 70th anniversary, we're celebrating peace on April 4th in commemoration of Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech against war on April 4, 1967, as well as his assassination on April 4, 1968. Martin Luther King Jr. said on April 4, 1967, quote, "As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they asked, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They asked if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. End quote. While Donald Trump once blurted out the obvious, that NATO is obsolete, he subsequently professed his commitment to NATO and began pressuring NATO members to buy more weapons. In fact, Trump has evicted Russian diplomats, sanctioned Russian officials, put missiles practically on Russia's border, sent weapons into Ukraine, lobbied European nations to drop Russian energy deals, left the Iran agreement, torn up the INF treaty, rejected Russia's offers on banning weapons in space and banning cyber war, expanded NATO eastward, added a NATO partner in Colombia, proposed adding Brazil, demanded and successfully moved most NATO members to buy significantly more weapons, splurged on more nukes, bombed Russians in Syria, overseen the largest war rehearsals in Europe in half a century, tried to overthrow the government of Venezuela and demanded that Russia stay out, condemned all proposals for a European military, insisting that Europe stick with NATO. Can one imagine a worse candidate about which to fantasize servitude to Vladimir Putin? NATO has pushed the weaponry and the hostility and the massive so-called war games right up to the border of Russia. NATO has waged aggressive wars far from the North Atlantic, has added a partnership with Colombia, abandoning all pretense of its purpose being in the North Atlantic. NATO is used to free the U.S. Congress from the responsibility and the right to oversee the atrocities of U.S. wars. NATO is used as cover by NATO member governments to join U.S. wars under the pretense that they are somehow more legal or acceptable. NATO is used as cover to illegally and recklessly share nuclear weapons with supposedly non-nuclear nations. NATO is used to assign nations the responsibility to go to war if other nations go to war, and therefore to be prepared for war. NATO's militarism threatens the Earth's environment. NATO's wars fuel racism and bigotry and erode our civil liberties while draining our wealth. We must say no to NATO, yes to peace, yes to prosperity, yes to a sustainable environment, yes to civil liberties, yes to education, yes to a culture of nonviolence and kindness and decency, yes to remembering April 4th as a day associated with the work for peace of Martin Luther King, Jr. For more information, go to notonato.org. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, for many of us, while we recognize that the priorities and practices of news media affect our lives, news programming isn't where we live, so to speak. It's creative media, dramas, comedies, even cartoons that engage us with their opportunity to stretch imaginations, shift perspectives, and reveal hidden experiences, which contributes to our disenchantment when the same structural problems that plague other U.S. institutions show up in this realm, too, as we're reminded every time we read a report on the staffing of, for example, television shows. Year after year, we see people with disabilities, people of color, women, and LGBTQ people un- and underrepresented in the rooms where ideas are generated. And year after year, Hollywood pledges to do better. A new report on TV writers looks beyond the promises and talks about the experiences of what it calls diverse writers once they get the job. The research comes from a group of TV writers called the Think Tank for Inclusion and Equity. We'll hear from project leaders Shireen Razak and Tawal Panyakasit Jr. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. It should go without saying that things we don't have names for go without saying. For years, that's been the deal with corporate media and racism. Actions, policies, statements, and ideas that regular people have no trouble identifying as racist in elite media hands become racially tinged, racially charged, race-related. And if racism isn't a thing our famously objective reporters can see, well, maybe it's not really out there, right? Things came to a forehead-slapping peak when Representative Steve King said to the New York Times, quote, "White nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive? Why did I sit in classes teaching me about the merits of our history and our civilization?" Close quote. Endorsing the supremacy of white people. That's racist, right? Leaked reports showed NBC News, for one, instructing staffers otherwise. "Be careful to avoid characterizing King's remarks as racist," read the internal guidance, adding, "It's okay to attribute to others, as in what many are calling racist or something like that." Well, laugh if you will, NBC was reflecting polite society's rule that besmirching someone white, that is, with the label racist, is worse than degrading the humanity of millions. Shamed on social media, NBC reversed course, and now Industry Bible, the AP style book, is reinforcing the move to reality land. The 2019 edition tells journalists, quote, "Do not use racially charged, racially divisive, racially tinged, or similar terms as euphemisms for racist or racism when the latter terms are truly applicable. Mississippi has a history of racist lynchings, not a history of racially motivated lynchings. He is charged in the racist massacre of 9 people at a black church, not the racially motivated massacre of 9 people at a black church." Close quote. It might seem superficial, but for a press corps that calls itself clever for splintering off fact-checking from reporting and that chest thumps about the First Amendment but doesn't defend whistleblowers when they go to prison, symbols can mean a lot. There's something else in the new AP guide. It says, quote, "Deciding whether a specific statement, action, policy, etc. should be termed racist often is not clear-cut. Such decisions should include discussion with colleagues and or others from diverse backgrounds and perspectives," close quote. That diverse people need to be in the room. That reporting involves listening to and learning from them. Now there's a radical idea. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. TV TV, for many of us, is a place where, at the end of the working day, you can experience places and circumstances far from your own, where human lives can be shown more three-dimensionally than on the nightly news, and where people who are marginalized and worse, in, quote, real life, can be the star and speak in their own voice. It matters deeply that, even as it expands in platforms and formats, TV is not actually exploring all of its creative potential, simply because the people telling the stories do not themselves represent the range of identities and experiences that exist in the world. Those who could bring the underserved perspectives, people of color, women, LGBTQ and non-binary people, people with disabilities, and all of the intersections of those, are not just rarely hired to be the storytellers. If they do get in the room, they're treated differently than their white, male, cis, and abled colleagues, such that their voices still can't always come through. A new report called Behind the Scenes, The State of Inclusion and Equity in TV Writing, documents the issue and suggests responsive actions. The research comes from the Think Tank for Inclusion and Equity, a consortium of working TV writers from various segments of the industry. We're joined now by the project's leaders, Shireen Razak and Tawal Panyakosit Jr. They join us by phone from Los Angeles. Welcome to Counterspin, Shireen Razak and Tawal Panyakosit Jr.
Hi, thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, we're excited to be here.
Well, folks may say, of course, we know this, but documentation is critical for a problem that can be hard to pin down and easy to wave away. TV jobs, more so than some others, are based on person-to-person connections, getting the right meeting with the right person. And there's not always going to be a smoking gun, as it were. They can just say, no thank you. So I'm guessing that part of the aim of this research was to give some specificity, to name some particular things that happen and the effect that they have, rather than simply say, TV writing isn't diverse enough.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, when we started down this road, it actually started with a diversity town hall that was about 3 years ago that I went to. And I was listening to the stories of a lot of diverse writers at that town hall, and they echoed a lot of the same stories that I was hearing from many of my diverse writer friends about, you know, issues that they're facing in the rooms, barriers to advancement and that kind of thing. But a lot of that, whenever we would talk to other people, these stories were dismissed as anecdotal or the exception. And so what we decided to do when we brought the Think Tank for Inclusion and Equity together was to try and put numbers to those anecdotes to prove that it wasn't exceptional or anecdotal, that there are systemic barriers.
Yeah, you know, I think that what's really important to note is this is really the first time that TV writers are talking to others in the industry and really lifting the veil behind what's happening in the writers' room. And, you know, there's lots of amazing, I think, studies out there that often are done by, you know, activist organizations and have really set the stage for a lot of the work that we're doing here. But we really wanted to share kind of from the vantage point inside the writers' room what is actually happening and connect, as Shireen was saying, connect numbers with those anecdotes.
Absolutely. And I think the part of the value of this work is that it says that, you know, hiring and inclusion are not the same thing, you know, and I think that's really critical. To me, one of the standout findings, if we can just get into it, is that 78% of writers of color said that they were the only person of color on their staff. And then I was surprised and disheartened to learn that that tokenism is actually structural. What is the diversity hire? And then what's the effect of that?
I can actually speak to that from experience. I was the diversity hire on two shows when I first started out. And it's basically the diversity slot is for staff writer, which is the entry level point to writer's room. And generally speaking, what that is that networks create these positions on their shows, and the money for those writers comes out of the network's budget as opposed to the show's budget. Now, it's great for getting people that foot in the door, but the problem is the next year, the next season, if the show gets picked up, then that writer's salary now has to come out of the show's budget. So what ends up happening is this revolving door where showrunners don't want to take on that financial burden, and so instead go for another free writer as opposed to bumping up the writer that has been in the room and contributing to the story.
Yeah, it's important to note also that in this day and age where there's increased hunger for diverse stories that represent all of America and in the world even, when you're the only person in the room and generally it's at the staff writer level, you know, TV writers' rooms are generally very hierarchical. So when you're the lowest person in the room, you're there to be the idea machine, but not necessarily to have any sort of decision-making power in terms of what actual stories make it to script and eventually to the screen or casting. And that's really why I think we chose, you know, we're TV writers, but also because writers are producers and really shepherd stories from creation to production and all the way through.
Well, I just think that this is a surprise, I think, to a lot of listeners to know that the television shows that they're watching, and we're talking about cable, network, animated, you know, drama, comedy, you're spanning the whole range, that the idea that there is a diversity slot and that that is structurally different from the other writers, I genuinely think that folks are surprised by that. And the idea that that's kind of like, you know, we understand that we're supposed to have this voice, but we don't necessarily accept that we're really genuinely meant to incorporate it.
It really is a double-edged sword. While it does a great job of getting that foot in the door, and many writers express that both in the survey, and then we also did a series of kind of focus groups afterwards, and many express the stigma that you carry as a diverse writer, similar to kind of affirmative action, where there are questions or perception that somehow these writers are less talented or don't necessarily deserve to be there. And for many, that's just flagrantly untrue. Many of these programs are so rigorous.
The vetting process for most of the network programs is very intense, and they get thousands of submissions. And so the people that get into the programs are the cream of the crop. So to think of them as less than because they were hired because they are diverse, it's just holistically untrue.
We're not trying to downplay the role of programs and fellowships because those are absolutely crucial. But in trying to address one problem, which is entry, it really reveals a newer problem, which is advancement, is that once people are getting in the door, they're not progressing and getting promoted. Many are having to repeat titles once, twice. I mean, 73% of diverse writers across the board are repeating titles, which means they have to, you know, go back a second season at the same level. And 46, I think, had to do it twice or more.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a number of examples where people have had to do it 3, 4, 5 times. So this really starts to answer the question when people say, where are the diverse showrunners? Where are the diverse at their level? Well, they're there, but they're being systematically held back.
They have the experience, but they don't have the title.
I understand how often, and it's not just television, it's in lots of industries where the person of color or the LGBTQ person gets in there, they're the only person there, and then they feel this complicated responsibility where they both want to represent the stories that they feel only they can represent because they're not being represented, but they also want to do lots of other things. So tokenism works in a more complicated way than people might understand, right?
Gosh, there's so many different facets to that one statement. Well, one of them is just that once you're in the door and there's the version of the room where they look at the diverse writer as being the person that's going to answer all the questions about every possible diversity there is.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, for me, being South Asian, having to comment on what the Vietnamese community is like is just kind of absurd. But that's sometimes expected. The other version of this can be that you're the only diverse voice in the room. You're also the lowest level on the totem pole, and so they don't listen to you at all. They kind of expect you to just sit in the corner and be silent.
many of us are more than just our identity.
Yeah.
We're genre geeks or stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, Paul and I are a great example of this, is that one of the reasons we wanted to be TV writers is because we're huge genre geeks.
Sci-fi, fantasy, mm-hmm. or all that stuff.
Right.
And, you know, we can bring a lot to those genres from our backgrounds, but it's also just we're big geeks. I mean, we want to write those genres, and we shouldn't be relegated to basic dramatic storytelling where there is a diverse character.
Right. And I think that was one of our findings, too. It was like something like 51% of diverse writers that never worked on a show that had non-diverse leads. So in other words, it's almost like what it really points to is that sometimes diverse writers aren't even in the room because there needs to be some sort of justifying factor. If there's not a Black storyline or a Chinese storyline or a gay storyline or a storyline about people with disabilities, then there's no need to have those people in the room.
Right.
And so I think that really speaks to what you're talking about, Janine, which is the recognition that people are three-dimensional beings. And I think what we're really hoping for is the ability to bring those three dimensions into the room.
Years ago, a columnist writer, Anna Quindlen, was talking about editors who were rejecting her column. And they would say, oh, we don't need your column. We already carry Ellen Goodman, who was another white woman, you know. And so what Anna Quindlen said was, well, there's not only a quota, there's a quota of one. And that was just evidence that there's not an actual understanding that inclusion and diversity enriches and improves. It's not like take your medicine and then you can go play again.
Right.
It's that this is actually makes the work better. I feel like I should just say period, but I would add that one of the things that the report underscores is that it also is good business. If you're trying to say you're interested in business, well, it's also good business, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think I heard a statistic that by, I think it's 2042, minorities will be the majority. And if that's true, there needs to be a lot more representation on TV, and there needs to be a lot more authentic storytelling to reach those audiences and to feed the hunger for authentic stories for those audiences.
I think lots of us look to, I know that lots of us look to creative arts like music, like movies, like television, not just as an escape from our daily life, though heaven knows that can serve a useful function, but as offering different ways to look at life and different lives to look at. You know, I doubt you could count the number of white people, for example, who changed their minds about Black people because they saw Bill Cosby. It's just true. There are lots of folks who have that cousin who hates the gays, but, you know, Queer Eye, it's so great. It's so fun and human. You know, television changes our view of the world and of one another. It's a keystone industry.
It saves lives. Before TV writing, I was an activist and organizer, and so that's kind of how I got involved in all this. I actually wanted to get into TV writing because it was something that I loved. It was something that always brought me solace and comfort, especially during those times when I was struggling with identity and feeling alone and isolated. But I could find myself reflected in shows and in people, and that made it a little better. That made it a little easier getting to that next day. And I wanted to really do that for others, and it was a real eye-opener to realize that, you know, that I wanted to write stories that could kind of change the world, but that even in TV writing itself, that a lot of the same things that we wanted to speak to are being experienced by TV writers.
There's no excuse for discrimination in any field, but it seems weirder when the field is creative. You know, you can do a show about talking cows in outer space, but it can't be written by a person with a disability. You know, it just shows that the criteria, once again, are just people, you know, people who are used to being with people who look like them. And yet, in a way, the impact is kind of multiplied because this is our window on other worlds, on other possibilities.
TV is a platform. Regardless of how you feel, you're making a statement either way. You're adding something to the culture.
Yeah, and one of our friends often says, with a great platform comes great responsibility. And we
totally Spider-Man, but
yeah. But we take that very, very, very seriously, and we want all TV writers to take that very seriously, because if we're perpetuating stereotypes on screen, we're putting that out there into the general consciousness, it's contributing to the divisiveness in society. So we can get rid of those stereotypes and speak to the communities that are being essentially demonized on TV and show them as human beings, amplify their humanity. It could help with a lot of the problems that we're having in society right now.
The report that we're discussing, Behind the Scenes, the State of Inclusion and Equity in TV Writing, it's self-reported from TV writers, but it also swept in a lot of television writers. You know, it's also representative in many ways. And so I want to ask you about that, but also what about the recommendations that the report provides, and what do you make of the response to it?
In terms of our sample, we definitely wanted to be conservative. I think it was important that we didn't overreach. We wanted this to be taken seriously, and so we were doing our due diligence. And you're right to say that, you know, the sample was self-reported, self-selected. So what that means is we can really only confidently, statistically speaking, speak to the experiences of the writers who took the survey. But here's the other thing. The actual numbers, representation for many diverse writers working are so small that we, in our collection, we managed to hit about 10% of all TV writers, almost a quarter of all women, non-binary working TV writers, 50% of people of color. The numbers, unfortunately, aren't tracked for LGBTQ and people with disabilities, so we're not sure what percentage, but we imagine we captured a high percentage of those people, too, because those numbers are so small. And because, as Shereen pointed out earlier, many of us are all connected. We speak to each other. We provide support for each other to lean on as we're kind of going through some of these challenges.
In terms of recommendations, we've broken them up by different groups, I guess you could say. We've looked at it from the perspective of what can agencies and management companies do better? What can studios and networks do better? What can showrunners and upper levels do better? And what can the guilds and the unions do better? Some of the recommendations are spread across all of them because it's a big issue. It's a big problem, and it's going to take everybody working together. The first and foremost thing that we need is better reporting and tracking of the data, because the only way we're going to know if we're moving the needle or if things are getting better is if the data is being collected and reported.
And reviewed.
Yeah, reviewed, and that it's transparent.
One of our biggest recommendations is also just education. A lot of writers are creative geniuses, and then they're thrust into the showrunner role where they have to oversee hundreds of employees, as well as the writer's room, including the writer's room. And many don't have any general management experience. So, you know, management education is important. Implicit bias, just really thinking about kind of how can we be more open and really more aware about how our biases are impacting our worldview and our interactions with others. I think really bringing that, there's an opportunity there. I think, you know, for all of us, I think education is something that we could all really truly benefit from. And then lastly, you know, I think people kind of ask, like, well, why does this matter? Why is this important now? You know, some of the things we found, for example, 64% of diverse writers have experienced bias, discrimination, harassment in the writer's room. This is an urgent issue. And so one of the other major kind of recommendations is that there has to be an independent kind of third-party reporting system for people, somewhere that's not at the same studio where people are worried about, am I going to be able to get hired by them next time? Or, you know, really, really providing some safe kind of outlet for reporting. And we're also talking about exit interviews and why those are important.
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of times when writers are not asked back to a show, the narrative that is presented to the networks and the studios is entirely coming from the showrunners and the upper levels, but the writer who's being let go is never allowed to tell their side of the story. And so for diverse writers,
I mean, you're scared to tell their side of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, there are a lot of stories that we've heard from the salons, from the survey, and from talking with our friends that the reason why people are being let go or why people sometimes are choosing to leave, there are significant reasons in that they need to be addressed by the networks and the studios, which is why we want exit interviews to be implemented.
Well, and I think also activating audiences and helping audiences understand what they're missing, because I want to say that although I knew the hiring numbers, generally speaking, I was not aware of the behind-the-scenes things that were happening that were keeping even diverse folks who were hired from getting their voices through. And I think a lot of folks are in that position. And, you know, we're sort of thinking this is a creative realm. We're getting to see all the best that's coming at us. And so I think that just this behind the scenes, as the report is titled, is very, very useful. And that audiences will also be very useful in demonstrating their hunger for these new kinds of stories.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that I can definitely say is that networks and studios are very much tracking what's going on, especially on Twitter, what people are saying about the shows, what they like about the shows, what they don't like about the shows. So if there's something that audiences want or want more of, or something that they don't like, you know, social media is a great thing sometimes.
Well, let me just ask you, Shireen Razack and Tawal Panyakosit Jr., final thoughts, things you'd like to say to listeners about this new report, why you think it's so important.
One of our recommendations absolutely is that the industry as a whole needs to kind of pull resources together and create a system for monitoring, tracking, and reviewing inclusion and equity in writers' rooms, but also within the ranks of executives and the different kind of players. But we will do it again if we have to. And I think it's important that this is really, and you know, I said it before, but this is unprecedented. This is really kind of the first time that people within the industry, I think, are really trying to speak up and on these issues. And we're following writers' room rules, which is, you know, it's not just about identifying problems, but it's about coming with solutions. And that's really what we wanted to do. There are a lot of amazing groups and entities that are doing this work already. And we wanted to provide whatever support we could from our insight in the room. And I think what we really hope to see at the end of the day are writers' rooms where everyone can, you know, respectfully contribute without fear, censure, or retaliation, where the stories and the people are thriving in a safe and creative environment.
We've been speaking with Tawal Panyakosit Jr. and Shireen Razack of the Think Tank for Inclusion and Equity. The report is called Behind the Scenes, The State of Inclusion and Equity in TV Writing. Tawal Panyakosit Jr. and Shireen Razack, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the National Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Not so long ago, global carbon dioxide rose a shocking 40 parts per million in just a few decades. Humans were alive then, but ecologically speaking, we were just animals. Scientists are rushing to find the cause of that natural instability and whether it could happen again. From Australia, Dr. Laurie Menviel explains. We are also joined by Matt Fitzpatrick, head of the Global Change and Biodiversity Lab, where you can find a map showing the future climate for most cities in North America, similar to one available for Europe. In between, you will hear tidbits of the latest from British journalist and climate campaigner George Monbiot at an Extinction Rebellion event. I'm Alex Smith. Find the future here on Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
The Great Southern Ocean, reaching down to Antarctica, has absorbed up to 10% of our greenhouse gas emissions. Without that, we would be much hotter already. But that ocean sink appears to be weakening. In a worst-case scenario, scientists are exploring why carbon dioxide jumped 40 parts per million in a few decades, and not that long ago, and whether that natural increase in warming gases could happen again. Dr. Laurie Menviel is a leading scientist in the field with many papers. She is currently a researcher at the University of New South Wales in Australia. Laurie was just awarded the 2019 Dorothy Hill Medal for her work as a groundbreaking young scientist. From Sydney, Laurie Menviel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Your field of study, it seems huge to me. How would you describe your work?
Well, I'm interested in periods of abrupt climate change and particularly in the role of the oceanic circulation. So most of my research focuses on constraining changes in oceanic circulation and understanding their impact on climate, the carbon cycle, and the continental ice sheets.
Well, today we come to you out of concern for our common climate future, but to get there, we do need to examine relatively abrupt climate shifts in the past. Please tell us about the brand new record of past climate published by a big team led by A.P. Hasenfratz.
Yes, so Hasenfratz recently published this exciting new record. So Hasenfratz and Carter present a 1.5 million years record from the Southern Ocean. So they took a marine sediment core in the Southern Ocean, and they analyzed both surface and deep changes in temperature and the oxygen isotopic composition, which is here a proxy for salinity. So from there, they can infer changes in or past changes in ocean stratification in the Southern Ocean. So what they find is an increase in Southern Ocean stratification during glacial times as Earth's climate went through a fairly large transition whereby the glacial times became much more intense. So this is known as the Middle Pleistocene transition. So basically, their study, what it does, it highlights the possible role of changes in Southern Ocean stratification in the climate and the carbon cycle.
You know, as a lay person, it appears from reading your papers that in Earth's latest glacial times and what you're describing, the planet's climate went a bit rogue. It was departing from that previously predictable cycle caused by our orbit and our tilt. What do you think changed?
Yeah, so basically over the last, let's say, million years and even more than that, Earth's natural variability has been dominated by what we call glacial interglacial cycles. So due to Earth's orbit around the sun, we do go from relatively warm period interglacial down to cold period glacial. But there are feedbacks within the Earth systems that amplify those cycles, and those are changes in continental ice sheet and in greenhouse gases, so namely atmospheric CO2 or methane. And so what happened is that, let's say, before this transition, the mid-Pleistocene transition, which occurred somewhere in between 1.2 million years and 700,000 years ago, so before this transition, there were glacial-interglacial cycles, but with a fairly small amplitude, both in terms of climate and CO2. And when we went through this transition, glacial became much more severe, they became much more cold, much colder, and atmospheric CO2 was also much lower. So we're trying to understand what happened, and in fact, the community is still really trying to fully comprehend the transition. But what comes out of it is that we know that atmospheric carbon dioxide is a very strong greenhouse gas and can impact significantly the climate. And we know that it decreased significantly, and this could be due to several effects, one of them being changes in the oceanic circulation in the North Atlantic. So North Atlantic deep water maybe became weaker and shallower. We also know that maybe iron fertilization in the Southern Ocean increased, so boosting up the production in the Southern Ocean, which then leads to more carbon storage in the ocean and less carbon in the atmosphere. And what Azenfrat highlighted is also changes in Southern Ocean stratification, so most likely a weaker circulation in the Southern Ocean, which can also lead to more carbon storage in the ocean and less in the atmosphere.
Well, I think this is a really important point, because we have what was predictable by our position in space and the way the sun operates, and then we go into a period which just humans evolved during this period, where something on Earth itself changed. And so we're very concerned that changes right here on Earth could again happen. And is that why you're doing your research?
Well, yes. So what we're trying to really understand is the feedbacks and that occur in the Earth system. So what glacial interglacial cycle show us is that there are what we call positive feedbacks. And so if you change something, then it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, it's not only positive, because obviously when we are in a very cold period, then it becomes warm again very quickly. So there are this series of feedbacks and interaction within the climate systems that can lead to sometimes rapid changes or et cetera. So yes, this period is really important to understand, just to understand the Earth system, how it works, and if we understand better that, then we can better predict what's going to happen.
If we look at just the Northern Hemisphere, how big were those changes between deep glacial times and the interglacial period, say in temperatures? How much did things vary?
Well, if you look at the equator, the changes were fairly small, let's say in the tropics, they were in between 1 to 2 degrees Celsius in the ocean. But as you move towards the pole, they become larger and larger. And ice core record from Greenland suggests maybe up to 20 degrees Celsius changes, so fairly large, and maybe about the same in Antarctica.
And did that take thousands of years, or how fast did those changes happen?
So there are several kind of variability, but if we look at the glacial-interglacial variability, we know a deglaciation, so a transition from a full glacial to an interglacial, takes about 10,000 of years in total. But there are periods within that where there is a much more rapid warming. So it's not like a constant and slow change in temperature. It's more like period, maybe you go back into a colder state and then suddenly it becomes very warm again and then it changes. So we have seen in the record a period of abrupt warming in Greenland, for example, where you can have a temperature increase of about 8 degrees Celsius in just a few decades, so in less than 100 years. It's also much. You can have very rapid warming.
For most of us, it's surprising to learn that the Earth doesn't always warm or cool as a whole, but that the two poles seem to alternate. Do we know why a colder period in Greenland was accompanied by a warming closer to the South Pole?
Yeah, so what happens is that within this glacial-interglacial variability, we also have what we call periods of abrupt climate change, and those periods seem to be due to changes in the oceanic circulation. So right now we have formation of deep water in the North Atlantic, so in the Labrador Sea and the Nordic seas, and so this water becomes very dense and sink to the bottom of the ocean and flow southward in the Atlantic. So this oceanic, what we call this oceanic circulation, also drives a surface flow, so there is a heat transport from the tropics to the North Atlantic, for example. So when this formation of deep water is fairly intense, we have fairly warm condition in the North Atlantic, for example, England, you have this Gulf Stream, which is part of this circulation, brings heat from the tropics to the UK, maintaining a fairly mild climate there. But we know that during past periods, this formation of deep water weakened significantly or even maybe completely shut off. So when this happens, you completely reduce your heat transport to the North Atlantic and you have very cold conditions over the whole North Atlantic, Greenland, Europe, etc. But since the ocean is the one transporting the heat, if you wish, when you actually reduce your transport to the North Atlantic, you can keep more heat in the south, in the Southern Ocean. So when you have this period of very strong cooling in the north, you have maybe warmer condition in the south. But there are also things that, I mean, details that we don't really fully comprehend. And right now we always think about Southern Ocean as a passive, as being passive simply, so just responding to changes in the North Atlantic. But this might not be so simple, and there might be changes in circulation in the south as well, influencing this heat redistribution. And also one of the important aspects is that the atmospheric carbon dioxide composition might also change during this event, potentially influencing or amplifying the changes.
Now, have you been studying solely a story at the poles? I mean, how do we know that at times the change was global?
Yeah, so not myself, but a lot of people study climate archives. So if we want to look into what happened in the past, we rely on those archives. So they can be ice cores from the pole, as you say, from Greenland or from Antarctica, but they can also be marine sediment cores that are taken all over the Atlantic Ocean or even in the Pacific and Indian Ocean. So when you analyze those marine sediment cores, you can see changes that happen at several places on Earth. And we also have terrestrial archives. So, for example, some archives that are very useful are speleothems. And we know from Chinese speleothems that the Asian monsoon changed significantly. Or we also know from speleothems in Turkey or Italy that precipitation was significantly different during those periods of time. There are also lake records that can tell us, or electric records from Europe or from South America, for example. So we know that those events were global. And then what we use as well are numerical simulations. So we use models, numerical models, and we try to reproduce what happened maybe in the North Atlantic or in the Southern Ocean. And then we understand what the drivers were and what the impact were, and we can see that the impacts were global.
Most of the climate scientists are in the Northern Hemisphere still, and we know a lot more about the North Atlantic than the South Atlantic. I wonder if a bias has developed that favors the Arctic as a driver of big changes while leaving out some important developments in Australia and in the Antarctic. What do you think?
Yeah, so it's an interesting point you're raising, and obviously there is a bit of that, and I think mostly in terms of the climate archive we have. So we have very good climate archive from Greenland, and a lot of sediment cores, marine sediment cores, have been taken from the North Atlantic. So we know that the North Atlantic was very viable, and we also know that the formation of North Atlantic deep water has a significant impact on climate globally. So this has been studied in quite a bit of details, and we try to have a kind of an idea that, you know, the North Atlantic is a significant driver of global climate change. But over the years, we're now starting also to understand that it's not only the North Atlantic, but the North Pacific, for example, can also have an impact on all of the Pacific, if you want, climate, and the Southern Ocean. So both regions are understudied, both in terms of climate archive and modeling, but we're getting there. We are trying to realize that those regions can also have a significant impact, and we're working on it. And we also, of course, have to take into account that I mean, we know that the North Atlantic is a significant driver, but it's been highlighted over the recent years that the tropical Pacific is also very important. And if you think about El Niño-Southern Oscillation, we know it has it is one of the main modes of variability in the equatorial Pacific and has significant impacts to teleconnection on both the Southern Ocean and maybe other regions. So, yes, the climate system as a whole is kind of tied together.
Laurie Manfield, you have studied in detail the rapid transition from the last glacial time to our present climate. When did that happen, and how fast did it occur?
Yeah, so the last transition, so what we call the last deglaciation from the last glacial maximum to our present interglacial, occurred from about 18,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago, so in about 8,000 years. But it was not a gradual change. As I say, we had abrupt climate variability within this transition, so when it went from colder to warmer, etc.
Do we know what caused a fairly quick burst of 40 parts per million carbon dioxide at the end of the last ice age?
Yeah, so that's something that's very interesting. So just at the end, to get out of this glacial climate, there was an abrupt event in the North Atlantic, in fact, where we're seeing the formation of North Atlantic deep water weakened significantly. So Greenland in Europe was in one of its coldest stage right at the end of the last glacial. But on the other hand, we see that the Southern Hemisphere started to warm. So Antarctica started to warm, Southern Ocean became warmer, and atmospheric CO2, as you said, increased by 40 parts per million in just about 1,000 years, with some within this period, with some parts that where we see a significant increase over just a few hundred years. And so the hypothesis we put forward and in our modeling framework, but that's also been confirmed by some climate archive, is that the changes in the upwelling in the Southern Ocean were a significant driver of this change. So in the Southern Ocean, you have deep water that are rich in carbon and nutrients that upwell. And so if this upwelling, so if you bring deep water to the surface in a more intense way, then you can have an outgassing of carbon from the ocean into the atmosphere, basically. And we think that's what happened. So basically, there was a stronger circulation in the Southern Ocean, which drove more heat towards Antarctica, thus leading to reduction of sea ice, warmer condition, and an outgassing of CO2.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock from the University of New South Wales in Australia. We are talking with the oceanographer, Laurie Manfield. So, Laurie, let's talk about the ancient winds. What are the southern westerlies, and why do they matter to this study of climate?
Yeah, so one of the main features of the circulation in the Southern Ocean are those westerly winds, right? And they drive the circulation in the Southern Ocean, bringing what we call an upwelling, so bringing deep water to the surface. And in the ocean in general, you have more carbon stored in the deep than at the surface. And at the surface, the water equilibrates always with the atmosphere. Okay, so when you bring this deep water, which has a lot of carbon, to the surface, you expect an outgassing. So the ocean is losing carbon while the atmosphere is gaining carbon.
Several scientists on this program have presumed that as the world warms, strong westerly winds will tighten toward the South Pole, and that might change rainfall over Australia and rearrange the behavior of the Southern Ocean. Does that theory come from models, and how certain are we that that will happen?
Well, there are several aspects to it. First, this is something that has been observed over the last 2 decades or so. So that's, I mean, I guess you're touching one important point here, is that our instrumental record is kind of limited. It's been, I guess, 10 to 20 years that our capabilities to observe what's going on Earth has increased significantly through satellites and other means of observation, but our record is kind of short, so we need to go back in the past and try to get information to really see what's going on. But we think that over the last 20 years, the westerlies have been have increased in strength and have moved forward. And we can use also numerical models. So those numerical models that are developed in several countries all around the world, so in Australia, in the United States, in France, in Germany, etc., in the UK, in China as well. So those models are then run forward in time to try to predict or project what is going to happen. And I think most of the models suggest that those westerlies are going to keep on strengthening and be closer to the pole. Of course, there's always some uncertainty associated to it, but this one seems to be a robust feature of the model.
You know, other scientists suggest the availability of iron for carbon-grabbing plankton may have influenced the latest warm period. Why do you emphasize the role of winds instead?
Well, I think it's not necessarily instead. I mean, we know that the iron fertilization is an important aspect. So basically, the Southern Ocean is a special region in some aspects because it's what we call a high-nutrient, low-chlorophyll region, meaning that primary production is limited not by the availability of nutrients or macronutrients, but it might be limited by a micronutrient, which is iron. So if you add iron to the ocean, you expect that the phytoplankton can grow more quickly, and this phytoplankton does photosynthesis and therefore capture carbon and bring it down to at depth. So this is important, and I don't think nobody denies it. It's just that there are also other aspects that are important, and the winds are an important part. So they are just driving also the upwelling of nutrients to the surface and changing the condition, meaning if you have, let's say, a warmer Southern Ocean, you have conditions that are maybe more favorable also for primary productivity if you have less sea ice and warmer condition.
Laurie, are there any signals that during the relatively recent abrupt climate change that we're talking about in the last deglaciation, that the violence of storms increased? And if so, would that suggest we may experience more extreme storms if a similar shift towards those stronger westerlies and a changed ocean current happened?
Well, that's a very difficult question. So there is no record or nothing right now in our capability to see whether storms were stronger or not. Of course, that's what you would expect, I would guess. If the westerlies are stronger, you would expect more storms in the Southern Ocean. Now also the position of the westerlies is very important as to where the storms happen. So if you think about Australia, we go into an area which is maybe not my specialty, but if you think about Australia, and I think it will be more the location of the maximum of the westerlies that will impact storms more than its strength. Let's say if it's shifted too poleward, maybe storms will not reach directly Australia, etc. So that's one aspect of it. Now, for the future, of course, the strength of the westerlies will have an impact on the strength of the storm in the Southern Ocean. But again, if you go to mid-latitude countries, so Australia or other in South America, I don't necessarily know. I think the mean sea surface temperature will have a significant impact, and I think that's what we've seen in recent events. It's more an increase in mean sea surface temperature that can then generate stronger storms. This is difficult because it depends a lot on which latitude you're looking into, which system you're going into. And so I'm really looking at a mean climate. And so the deviation or what you look into, extreme storm, are another area of study.
I understand. Well, look, I began by saying that the Southern Oceans are grabbing about 10% of our current emissions, and thank goodness that they are. Can you tell us how the ocean manages to capture and store so much of our greenhouse gases?
It depends a lot on the difference in atmospheric carbon dioxide composition in between the atmosphere and the ocean. So what happened is that since the Industrial Revolution, we've been adding carbon into the atmosphere at, I think, about 2 gigatons per year. So the atmospheric composition in carbon dioxide has increased from about 280 ppm to 400 ppm, which is a concentration we haven't seen in, I would say, a million years, right? So the natural viability of atmospheric CO2 over a glacial interglacial cycle is 180 ppm to 280. So here we're going way higher. So you do change the sink and source of carbon when you do that. And as you say, thankfully, both the terrestrial biosphere and the ocean have absorbed a lot of our emissions. So about 30% has been absorbed by the terrestrial biosphere and 25% by the ocean. And a lot of this carbon has been absorbed in the Southern Ocean. The Southern Ocean is a very special place because this is where you form both the Antarctic bottom water and the Antarctic intermediate water, and in fact the subantarctic mode water. So when you form those waters, you have also the capability of absorbing carbon. Yeah, so basically we've changed, if you wish, the natural. So we are putting so much carbon into the atmosphere that the ocean now, partial pressure is lower than the atmosphere, so you're actually absorbing some of this carbon.
And a few years ago, British scientist James Lovelock warned about the ocean stagnating, breaking into layers called ocean stratification. Is that happening?
Yeah, so that's another very important point and a bit of concern, in fact, is that so what we have seen over the last 20 years and what you just said is that the southern hemispheric westerlies have strengthened and shifted poleward. Okay, so this has an impact of bringing more carbon to the surface, so you have an outgassing of carbon. But on the other side, since the circulation is fairly strong, you can also capture a lot of anthropogenic carbon. But on the other side, what we've seen, and we're still trying to understand exactly why, is that the Southern Ocean has become more stratified and maybe fresher, so indicating potentially a slowdown of this Southern Ocean circulation. So there are, in fact, almost two competing effects right now, is that one that is dynamic with the wind wanting to strengthen the Southern Ocean circulation, and one that is coming from maybe a meltwater input from Antarctica wanting to stratify the Southern Ocean and slowing down this circulation. So in the future, if we look at the coming 100 years or so, in fact, it's really unclear what is going to happen, and a lot of it will have to do into the freshwater budget close to the Antarctic coast.
Your recent article published in the journal Science on March 8th talks about a nonlinear response. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that basically we are not really sure where we're going, right? And we've seen in the past that Earth was able to go through rapid transition. In a few hundred years, we had, you know, significant warming or significant increase in atmospheric CO2. And we're still trying to simulate that with our models and understand it. And sometimes we've highlighted some positive feedback. So if you go back to Antarctica and the Southern Ocean, we know that if you have an increase in stratification, it's possible to have a warming in the subsurface, and this subsurface warming can then melt the ice shelf, and you can have, let's say, an increase in meltwater close to the Antarctic coast, further weakening the circulation and eventually leading to a significant loss of ice mass in the Antarctic. So this is, for example, what could happen in a positive feedback case, right? So right now, I think the concern is that we don't really know where we are going. We have some ideas, and we are trying to simulate possible response, but there are still surprises coming, and I guess we hope that there are good surprises and not bad, because we're still lacking a lot of information on possible rate of change, particularly continental ice sheet.
We're going to have to leave it there. We have been speaking with award-winning young scientist Laurie Manviel from the University of New South Wales. Find links to the science we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Laurie, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Well, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk to you, and I hope it was of interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
On March 28th, journalist and author George Monbiot spoke at Oxford University, organized by Extinction Rebellion. He found a cause for hope. Here are a few clips from that talk, available in full on YouTube.
Thank you very much, Ben, and thank you everyone for coming. Whoa, it's fantastic. Really great to see you all. Now, Brexit does not keep me awake at night. The political meltdown taking place in Britain does not keep me awake at night. Theresa May does not keep me awake at night, though she does often feature in my nightmares. The reason these issues, huge as they are, do not keep me awake at night is that I'm already sodding awake because I'm fretting about things 1,000 times bigger. We are being faced simultaneously with a series of humongous existential crises. Climate breakdown, ecological cascading collapse, the disappearance of insects. Who knew they were important? The cascading collapse of marine ecosystems as well as terrestrial ones, driven primarily, it has to be said, by the food industry. Farming and fishing, the two most destructive industries on Earth. We give them a free pass on the basis that you can't criticize any industry that features in a children's book. We are faced with the disappearance of soil. We're faced with the contamination and disappearance in many parts of the world of fresh water. Just 2 days ago, we learned that air pollution is causing twice as much damage to our health as we previously thought. And before that point, we already knew that worldwide it was three times more deadly than AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. And yet what we see from our political and economic class is a mixture of indifference and denial, occasionally grading into despair. Now, people of my generation, and I spent years grappling with this, denied and denied and denied, either that there was a problem at all or that the problem was as important as we know it is. And then suddenly, a few years ago, what they were saying changed. Suddenly, instead of saying, it's not an issue or it's not important, they said, okay, we accept it's an issue and it's important, but sadly, it's now too late to do anything about it. Between the denial and the despair, there was not one moment at which they said, it's real, it's an issue, and therefore we must act. And faced with this indifference, this despair, this denial, I began to fall into something resembling a state of despair myself. I thought people aren't going to see it. They refuse to see it. They don't want to know. And we tried and we tried to get mobilizations going, and we had small ones which flared up and then disappeared again like fireworks. We went up and we came down the same way. And I began to think nothing is going to take this on. Nothing is going to tackle this. And then suddenly, two extraordinary movements emerge just where I thought, just at the moment, I thought that hope had died. Extinction Rebellion and the climate strikes. And we honour and applaud all those magnificent people who have led these two converging and essential movements. Thank you to all of them. They give me hope where hope seemed absent. They give me determination where determination was flagging. And they give me belief that for the first time in years, a belief that we really can meet these issues head on and turn around our catastrophic political and economic systems so that they serve us rather than destroy us. And on that note, I want to introduce the wonderful speakers tonight. I'll be having a bit more of a go later on. But first of all, we have two fantastic people from Extinction Rebellion. Rachel Trahan, who's an Arctic ecologist and an Extinction Rebellion activist, and Zahora Plummer, who's also a great Extinction Rebellion activist. And we'll also be hearing from Lynette, who's 16 and represents the great youth surge, which has put so many of us grey heads to shame and is showing us the way forward. So, well, thank you, everyone, for those fantastic presentations. And, yeah, we need to be scared in order to see how much we have to do, and then we need to do it. Now, people often ask me, am I optimistic or am I pessimistic? And my answer is that I'm pessimistic about what people are doing to each other, doing to this wonderful planet, but I'm optimistic about what we are, because old Thomas Hobbes was wrong. We are not engaged in a war of all against all. Broadly speaking, we're a society of altruists governed by psychopaths. I mean it. Actually, again, the science shows very clearly that those people in positions of power, many of them are radically different to the human norm. They seem to be missing those components, altruism and empathy in particular, that the rest of us possess. And in this case, selfishness and greed really are at the top of the list. This is where we're going wrong, ladies and gentlemen. Why are we letting these bastards rule us? There's a very interesting analysis by Kenneth Mackay, a Canadian professor of sociology, who's looked at the cultures that have become extinct, where they should have been to one of these talks, but because they didn't, they went over the edge and they slipped into the extinction that we're talking about as a prospect, a possibility for humanity in general now. And he was saying, well, what is the common characteristic of all these cultures? Is it that they became overcomplex? Is it that they had a particular way of engaging with the living world, which was disastrous, or with each other, were they particularly warlike? And what he found was that the common denominator was they were all governed by oligarchies, by a very small number of people who had almost absolute power over everybody else. And that the interests, the short-term interests of the oligarchs were radically different to the long-term interests of society. And so that, though everybody else might have wanted to do things differently, these people were saying, our interests are pursued by doing it this way. Now, does that seem at all familiar in the 21st century? You know, we think about the Koch brothers, we think about Donald Trump, we think about Exxon, we think about BP, we think about this tiny handful of billionaires and corporations who want to do it their way, regardless of the impacts on the rest of us. And then we think of the rest of society who are either indifferent or in denial or really want things to be different. But the great majority of people are not saying, actually, we want to be hell-bound towards extinction because that suits our short-term interests. When people are given the opportunity to act, enough people are ready to do it. And with Extinction Rebellion, with the youth climate strikes, we are seeing the rising that I have been waiting for the 33 years of my campaigning life. I honour these people, I want us all to honour them, and I want us to see that this is the beginning, not of the end, but the beginning of the beginning of the great mass movement so many of us have been hoping to see for so long. It starts this year, ladies and gentlemen, and it starts with us. Thank you.
Find a link to the full video for George Monbiot and Friends at Oxford University, March 28th, in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Would you like to move your city to somewhere warmer? No need. According to new science, that different climate will probably come to you. By the end of this century, some American cities will experience climates not seen before. Our tour guide is the lead author of a new paper published in Nature. Mats Fitzpatrick leads the Global Change and Biodiversity Lab at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. He is listed as the principal investigator with a team of scientists and over 50 papers published. Mats Fitzpatrick, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Happy to be here. My actual affiliation is the full University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, which is separate from the University of Maryland.
Well, you're talking about kids today living in a city very different when they grow up. Can you give us a quick example of what maybe New York or Washington might be like around the year 2080?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, so we're looking only at the climatic aspects, but in terms of those, you know, New York, under our current emission trajectory, by about 2080 is going to feel like northeastern Arkansas feels today. So, you know, on a summer day, that's an average of about 9 degrees Fahrenheit warmer.
When a long winter hangs on like this one, a lot of my listeners would probably love to have a climate more like San Diego or Miami. Maybe global warming will be popular. What's the problem, they think?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had other people make that similar argument that, hey, you know, I'd love for the climate in my place to be warmer. And maybe, you know, you hear a lot about the risks of climate change, and maybe that's one of the rewards. And so the question is, do those sorts of do those outweigh the significant risks? And the sorts of risks we're talking about are changes in our ability to grow food, changes in the magnitude and number of extreme weather events, sea level rise that's going to flood coastal cities, movement of people responding to climate change, right? We're talking about climate refugees, potential conflicts over water. So there's a whole host of negative consequences that come along with climate change. And so I think if people want to live in a warmer climate, they'd be better off trying to fight climate change and moving.
We know that weather is different than climate, and the weather lately is sort of all over the place. It doesn't seem normal to some people, but humans, we can't see or feel the longer trend, the real climate change. How is your work trying to help overcome that?
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the most significant barriers, I think, to doing something about this problem is that we experience, you know, daily, seasonal, annual variation in climate, and that can mask some of these trends that we've seen over time. And, you know, the way that we're trying to combat that problem is to show people, you know, climate at a place now that's going to be that best represents climate at a future time. And if, you know, someone has a general understanding about how climate changes in North America or the United States, or they've traveled to these places or they've seen them on TV, that should give them a sense of the sorts of weather they might expect, even though we're not obviously forecasting weather in year 2080.
And for the new study and the handy interactive map, which I've checked out, we can all use it. You and Robert Dunn used a tool called climate analog mapping. That word analog isn't a common word for most of us, and we certainly did not learn that kind of mapping in school. What is it?
Yeah, so this is an idea that we didn't invent. It's been around for a long time, actually. And, you know, the basic idea is we're saying what place, what climate is most analogous or most similar to the climate expected at a place at another time. And so the basic underworkings of how that goes is that we have observations of current climate, of course, and then we have forecasts of climate. These are 30-year averages forecasted from climate models. And we're just saying, you know, where is there a place that is most similar to that forecast for that location?
We do have listeners in Europe. How does your city study compare to the 2018 work, Characterization of European Cities Climate Shift, led by Guillaume Rohat?
Yeah, so that is a very similar study. You know, the ideas are basically identical. I think the only difference between the two is that we're using a slightly different statistical methodology to measure the similarities. And, of course, we're working in a different place and with different climate projections. Those are minor differences, but yeah, the idea is basically the same.
Your research covered about 75% of the population of the United States and around half of the people of Canada, but I can't find a map for climate change in Canadian cities. Is that planned?
Yeah, so actually, if you go to the map, there are, I believe the number is, there's 10 Canadian cities on the app that people can look at. Most of those are along the border with the U.S. because that's where most of the population of Canada is. But cities like Montreal, Quebec City, Ottawa, Vancouver, et cetera, are all in the map.
And do we get to go to San Diego if we're living in Vancouver?
That's a good question. Vancouver is interesting. A lot of the West Coast cities, let me just have a look while we're talking here at Vancouver. I think Vancouver actually becomes a lot like Seattle. Yeah, but the one really important caveat that I try to get across, and this is a little bit technical, so I'm gonna do this slowly. So we're trying to find the current climate that's most similar to, let's say, Vancouver's climate, 2080. So, like, where is the location that has a climate that's most similar? And we do that by looking at every single location in the map, in the study region we considered. In this case, that's the Western Hemisphere north of the equator. So we look at every location, and we say, how similar is that location to 2080's climate in Vancouver? And then we find that what's the smallest distance, the closest similarity. But that doesn't mean it's actually all that similar, right? And so what we see for cities like Vancouver is that there's really not a good match, or it's a poor analog is what we would call that. And that means that the climate we expect in 2080 in Vancouver is actually unlike anything currently present in the study area that we considered. We call that climate novelty, and in more common vocabulary, we would say that, you know, the combination of precipitation or rainfall and temperature doesn't presently exist in the study area at present.
Yeah, I noticed that about the map. I mean, it seemed like various American cities in the East and the Midwest were pretty easy to understand, but the West Coast cities, in a couple of cases, you might have to go north to find an analog. And why is the West generally harder to understand?
Well, the climate patterns are more variable in the West because of the topography, because of the influence of currents along the West Coast. And the elevation also plays a factor. So you mentioned some cities having an analog to the north, and that's not all that surprising. It's in essence, if you have a city that's at a high elevation, its 2080s climate might match a lower elevation, right? That's warmer and drier today, and that might happen to be north of the city. And so that's why we tend to see that in the western U.S. especially.
Right, that makes total sense. So, previously, one of the challenges of science was interpreting global data into a local projection. How did you drill down to the city level when previous studies and reports have had difficulty doing that?
That's right. So, you know, the data that come out of these global climate models are what we would call relatively coarse spatial resolution. And you might think of this as like, you know, take a map and chop it into squares of equal size. And those squares are pretty big in terms of how the data comes out of the climate model. To get to the level of cities, we used data that had been what's known as statistically downscaled. So there's these techniques where they take the information from climate models and they reduce the spatial resolution down. The equivalent process, one way to think about this is older digital cameras, right? The older digital cameras might have, you know, they might be like 1 or 2 megapixels, right? That's like the number of pixels in the image that you take. And whereas today's cameras might be 12 megapixels, let's say. So in essence, that's what's happening is that we didn't do this work. This was done by an outside group. But they're taking these coarser resolution outputs from climate models, and they're statistically downscaling them to a more fine resolution, and that's the data that we used.
I did some digging around in the charts, and I was looking at Washington, D.C., and it appears to me from your paper, if we start from the period 1960 to 1990 as our baseline, the worst-case emissions scenario means that around March 2080 or so, Washington would be about 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer both days and nights and would experience an extra day of rain. Now, Matt, aren't we currently on the IPCC worst-case emissions pathway right now?
Yeah, we are. I believe we're either on that pathway or we've exceeded it or are exceeding it. And so we're on track, given current emission rates and the speed of global action, to be in the worst-case scenario.
Matt, how did you account for the other side of climate change, the new hydrology, the new patterns of humidity and storms and extreme precipitation events which are hitting the U.S. right now?
Right. So all of those factors we basically had to ignore. So we're talking about our 30-year averages of climate. So we use the term 2080, right, as the time frame we're talking about in the future. But what that actually refers to is the average of the period 2070 to 2099. So it's a 30-year average of climate. You know, we're not considering changes in the frequency of extreme events or any of those sorts of things that come along with these changes. We're also not considering sea level rise. That's going to probably be potentially the larger impact for low-lying coastal cities. And we're not considering things that are going to make the problem worse, like heat island effects, right? So the interior of cities are often several degrees warmer than the surrounding suburbs or countryside, given the large amount of buildings and that sort of thing that hold heat. So in a lot of ways, what we're showing here is conservative, potentially.
We know warming is going to continue for centuries after 2080, and I'm wondering, should we consider the same study for the year 2180 if we're trying to weigh up the risks of what we're doing now, or is that just too far out for us to even guess what might happen by then?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, they can certainly simulate climate out that far, and potentially people have. I'm not 100% sure. But, you know, this is one of the challenges of climate change, is that not only are the effects gradual, but they accumulate over time, and the severity of them becomes worse. But thinking even to 2080 is more than I think we as humans are readily able to conceptualize. Even though it is the lifetime of our children, you know, we're more worried about what's going to happen tomorrow or next week than we are about things that are several decades away. And so, you know, to me, this is the sort of problem that really requires a policy solution, because it has to change behavior now to have a benefit multiple decades in the future.
And according to your recent work, most northern cities will have climate more like what is seen in the south, more or less, today. So what happens to cities that are in the tropics now?
Yeah, that's a great question. The closest we get to the tropics in our analyses are like southern Florida and southern Texas, that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, there's a study that looked at a kind of more of a global perspective. It wasn't looking at cities, but it was looking at the idea of what I spoke about earlier about climate novelty. And it asked, you know, where do novel climates arise in the future, given climate change? And oftentimes, these novel climates are in the tropics, because the tropics are becoming warmer and that sort of thing. And so what I would say about, you know, cities in the tropics, there's probably not a good current analog for what those places will be like in the future, and that their climates will be unlike anything that we see potentially anywhere on Earth today.
Well, it's possible in some places where the humidity is high enough that those cities may be empty and those people may move north or south just to find a more habitable climate.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, humans have a way of figuring out how to inhabit some pretty extreme places.
You can help Radio EcoShock keep going. Make a donation at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Matt Fitzpatrick, and he's with the Fitzpatrick Lab at the University of Maryland. His latest work lets you see the coming climate in 540 American cities. Matt, the majority of the world's population now live in cities, and megacities are still expanding. How vulnerable are big cities to a shift in climate within one generation?
That's a good question. I mean, it's a bit outside of my expertise to think about it that way. The way that I think about cities and their vulnerability is that they're not natural environments, right? By their definition, they're heavily built environments. There's lots and lots of infrastructure in place to support population densities, transportation, et cetera. And so the extent to which those systems are or are not buffered from climate events could make those sorts of places very vulnerable to climate change.
Thinking about city planning, even with your new map, you say cities can't just click on a future and plan for that, because with climate disruption, well, how can city planners prepare for a variable future?
That's a good question. I mean, part of our initial goal with this was to potentially provide some forward-looking information to people making planning decisions, like, you know, looking at if my city is going to become like this location, you know, what are their cooling needs and buildings and that sort of thing. Reviewers actually pushed back on us on that and said, well, you know, this method hasn't been demonstrated to be useful for that, and you're speculating. So we removed a lot of that. So, you know, I think it's an open question, the extent to which climate analog mapping can be used for that purpose. But it should at least provide a sense of, you know, the sort of climate that these cities may experience, and that could translate into building codes and infrastructure development and engineering and that sort of thing. But yeah, again, I think it's a bit of an open question.
So people click on the map at tinyurl.com/urbanclimate. Perhaps they see what the future might look like for where they live, for their kids at least. Then we have to drive to work. Do we know if awareness really leads to action that will prevent a bad outcome with our climate?
That, too, is an open question. It's one that we're very interested in pursuing here at the Appalachian Lab. You know, we're curious about the use of a tool like this in terms of not just informing the public, but does it change people's engagement or awareness and that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I'd like to think it does, but the reality is we all have a lot of other things to think about. And again, that's where I think a policy solution is probably the best way to address this problem.
Before we wrap up, Matt, I'd like to just take a peek at some of your other research. You are an expert in phenology. What is that, please?
A lot of the work I do is related to the response of natural systems to climate variability, and what that tells us about how they might respond to future climate change. Some of my work works on phenology, which is basically the timing of events in the natural world. That means typically, you know, phenology events are very prominent in the spring and the fall, right? So flowers are blooming, leaves are coming out, birds are arriving in the north. So these are all phenological events. And climate is a big driver of when those events happen. And when the timing of those events change, they often have ripple effects through ecosystems. So there's lots of examples of changes in phenology events impacting other aspects of ecological systems.
I thought global warming was developing too fast for evolution to help species cope, but you study some kind of genetic adaptation. Can you talk to us briefly about that?
That's right. So, like, you know, these phenological events, you know, let's just stick with, like, the timing that a certain plant flowers. That's often under very strong genetic control. And given the new technologies in genomics, we are able to look more closely at the actual genetic basis for the timing of some of these events. And so I don't do any of the sort of nitty-gritty genetics work myself. I have collaborators that do that. My interest is more in taking those data and applying some of the modeling work that I do to understand what drives that variation within species, how is it related to climate, and can we use that to make predictions about how these events will change in the future.
I worry about one more underreported story from your work. Quote, aquatic ecosystems are considered among the most vulnerable and endangered in the world, with the projected future extinction rate of freshwater fauna rivaling estimates for tropical rainforest species. So we talk a lot about the rainforests, we worry about them, but we never hear about this serious freshwater extinction situation. We have been talking with Matt Fitzpatrick, head of the Global Change and Biodiversity Lab at the University of Maryland. On February 12, 2019, Matt and Robert Dunn published the paper Contemporary Climate Analogs for 540 North American Urban Areas in the Late 21st Century. They also gave America a tool to see the climate destination of their city. Find that interactive map at tinyurl.com/urbanclimate. I'll put links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Matt, thank you for giving us a good look at what could be a bad situation.
You bet, Alex. My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. At the end of last week, major cities in North Korea were threatened by wildfires. Early fires have already appeared in Western North America. Songwriter David Rovics realized he is an early climate change refugee. avoiding the summer smoke in Portland, Oregon, for a coffeehouse in Denmark. But then, projections for rising seas show Denmark could disappear as a country as surely as low-lying Pacific islands. Nobody escapes global climate change disruption. Regular listeners can see all this coming direct from our breaking science. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned to your future with Radio EcoShock.
I know we're creating a scene, but the creating a scene is not illegal. You are born free, you will live free, you will die free. You are allowed to make a scene. You're allowed to scream for joy. You're allowed to complain. You're allowed to cry. You're allowed to love people. You're allowed to hug people.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Joining us on the Electronic Intifada podcast is our colleague, Tamara Nassar. Tamara, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me, Nora and Issa. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for coming on. So we wanted to get a sense of what you've been focusing on recently through your work at the Electronic Intifada. Take us through a little bit about what you cover and the stories that you've been you've been reporting on lately and why they're important.
Absolutely. So in the past, I would say year or so, I have been focusing on Gulf states' growing normalization with Israel. This has largely been a covert effort, but is coming out of the shadows now with a mutual enmity towards Iran at the core of it. So that's really been my focus. Of course, in many of those Gulf states, the public is actually very opposed to normalization with Israel. So there's also been, I've been covering incidents where sport athletes or artists and other people from those countries who refuse to participate in tournaments or championships because there is Israeli participation. So that's my main focus, but I also write a lot about prisoners' affairs, Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, as well as Israeli demolitions and property seizures of Palestinians that occur within the occupied West Bank and the occupied Golan Heights, but also sometimes inside of Israel.
So speaking of which, you just published a story over the last few days about this just heinous, horrifying expulsion of a Palestinian family from their home that they've had for nearly 70 years in occupied East Jerusalem's Old City. Can you talk a little bit about this story, about this family, the Abu Asab family, and what happened to them over the weekend?
Absolutely. So Israeli occupation forces arrived to the Abu Asab family home in the Muslim quarter of occupied East Jerusalem on Sunday and forcibly evicted them from their homes and handed their homes over to Jewish settlers. So the Abu Asab family is originally from the Baqa neighborhood, which is located in western Jerusalem, where tens of thousands of Palestinians were forcibly expelled during the Nakba, which is the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians carried out by Zionist paramilitary forces in 1948. So this is not the first time that the Abu Asab family are rendered refugees in their own city. They moved to this home that they were just expelled from in 1952 after So the, when they were expelled from their original home in, their, in 1948, they first moved to Damascus Gates, near Damascus Gates in the old city, and then they moved to this home, which is originally owned by the Nusaybe family. It's a Palestinian family from Jerusalem called the Nusaybe family, who had leased the property to Jewish settlers, to the Jewish residents before 1948, and this lease was for 99 years. And despite the fact that the lease has ended, the family handed the property over to a trust, and then the trust was taken over by settlers who launched a legal effort against the Abu Asab family in 2014 to seize the home that they were living in, despite the fact that they were paying rent consistently to the absentee property guard. So under Israeli law, under the 1950 absentee property law, Israel has the right to keep Palestinian homes that Palestinians left or were forcibly expelled from in 1948, and would not allow Palestinians to reclaim their homes or even receive compensation for these homes. But a 1970 amendment to this law allows Jewish residents to reclaim property that they left in 1948. So this is a blatantly racist measure against Palestinians. And the Abu Asab family now cannot, for example, return to the home that they were forcibly expelled from in the Baqa neighborhood where they're originally from. But the Jewish settlers who now live in their home that they were just expelled from a few days ago is not even the same Jewish family that lived there before 1948. So this is a blatantly racist measure, and Palestinians, especially in occupied East Jerusalem, are constantly subjected to that kind of fear of being on the verge of imminent eviction, even after being in that home for about seven decades.
I think this is a good example of Israeli settlers essentially and what they do, and why the issue of Israeli settlements is not some sort of theoretical thing. It's part of, like, when we say the Israeli colonization of Palestinian land, and it's talked about by Palestine Solidarity campaigners in that way, it's not like a theoretical thing or a historical thing. It's something that's very actively going on, and it's something sort of these kind of evictions really sort of illustrate the brutality of Israeli colonialism and Israeli settlements. So how common is this sort of this kind of story is something that you cover a fair bit. So, like, how common is it for this kind of thing to happen in the West Bank and Jerusalem?
I would say it's pretty common. I mean, there's another family that's facing a similar legal battle right now. Actually, it's they're facing imminent eviction. The Israeli High Court ruled for their imminent eviction by January 23rd, so they could be evicted any day now. It's the Sabbagh family. They live in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem. It's a family of 40, 30 of which are children, and if they are evicted, these people have nowhere to go. They are originally from Yaffa, and they own two homes there. And following the Nakba, they moved to Sheikh Jarrah in 1956, and Israel took over their homes in Yaffa. So now if the Sabbagh family is actually evicted from their homes, from their home in Sheikh Jarrah, they cannot return to Yaffa, of course, and they will just be rendered homeless. So there was a quote by Muhammad Sabbagh, who is one of the older members of the family, who said, why can't I take my property back from 1948? The same way, you know, Israel wants to seize this property in the name of, you know, this, that it belongs to Jewish residents before 1948. So I would say it's pretty common, especially in occupied East Jerusalem, where Israel is further entrenching its occupation through either literally forcibly evicting Palestinians from their homes or pumping money into settlement projects, and there was a recent report in Israeli home about an Israeli government agency called the Company for the Reconstruction and Development of the Jewish Quarter, which is a company wholly owned and established by the Israeli government. And they just allocated $55 million for projects in Jerusalem. Of course, these projects are being done in the name of tourism and developing tourist routes and all of that. But Israeli human rights group Ir Amim says that Israel uses this excuse of exploiting tourism as a tool for reinforcing settlement initiatives in Jerusalem and basically trying to erase Palestinian presence from the city by tightening its grip on it. So, you know, this is just one form of many ways that Israel is tightening its grip on Jerusalem and trying to change the characters of the city so that Palestinians either leave it or are rendered invisible in it. After the eviction of the Palestinian Abu Asab family on Sunday, Israeli forces closed the doors of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and closed and placed locks on the Bab al-Rahma site where Palestinians pray. And I mean, it's collective punishment.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's the way that Israel entrenches its occupation is multifaceted. And I suppose reading your latest article about this, which we'll link to when we post this podcast, your article is titled "Settler Soldiers Seize Jerusalem Home from Palestinian Family." And it's completely common, I suppose, to answer my own question to you. And as you said, it's a very common thing to happen for Palestinians to be expelled in this way. And I suppose in your article, the only thing that struck me as unusual was that they would even have any kind of connection. The Jewish settlers would have any kind of connection to the Palestinian home. That's the unusual aspect of it, because, you know, as you've alluded to in talking about the Israeli laws, the racist Israeli laws, any Jewish person from around the world, whether or not they have any kind of connection to Palestine, has more of a right to, under Israeli law, to settle in Palestinian homes than Palestinians themselves. Mate, can you talk a little bit about Israeli settlements and how Israeli law kind of discriminates against Palestinians in that way?
Yeah, I mean, Israeli settlements are some of the most, or house some of the most racist Israelis in the Palestinian Mandate. So it's you're absolutely right that most of the time when these kinds of things occur, settlers are firmly protected by Israeli soldiers. So this Israeli family who just moved into the Abu Asab family home walked into the house right in front of them, and they, while Israeli soldiers were beating Hatem Abu Asab and arresting him along with his son and beating one of the aunts of the family. So it's like you said, any Jewish person from anywhere in the world has more claim over Palestinian land and property than Palestinians who have been living there for decades. And this Jewish family that's just moved into the Abu Asab family home, not only do they have no connection to the family home, but let's say for a second that it was actually the Jewish family that lived there before 1948. They were not even the owners of this house. The actual owners of this house are the Nusaybe family who were leasing the home for the Jewish family that was living there before 1948 and fled after the Nakba. So it's this family is originally owned by Palestinians as well. So but Israeli law still allows the High Court to hand over one Palestinian home to another Jewish family without, you know, without any problem or, you know, legal battle under Israeli law.
And you look at the video, and we'll link, of course, to some of the videos that you embedded in your report on this, Tamara. But, I mean, it's not just like, you know, this you know, a couple of police officers, you know, protecting this, you know, this settler family, you know, and easing their you know, casual transition into this Palestinian family's home. This is like a highly militarized, I mean, there were like dozens of police, of Israeli police, some of whom you mentioned, as you mentioned, were beating some of the members of the Palestinian family, and preventing the family and people in the community from protecting the family from being evicted as their home was being seized by these settlers. And this isn't just like, you know, as you were mentioning, this isn't just a one-off thing. This isn't just an anomaly situation. This is happening all the time, not just in East Jerusalem, but elsewhere in the West Bank. And as well, you know, in places inside Israel itself, you've also been documenting the forced expulsion of Palestinian Bedouin in the Nakab, in the Negev Desert. As well as other communities inside the Jordan Valley. Can you talk a little bit about those stories as well and how these home evictions that we're seeing in broad daylight in Jerusalem are connected to what's happening inside the Nakab and in other Palestinian communities around historic Palestine?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd like to also talk about the community, the Palestinian village of Khan al-Ahmar, which has been facing imminent demolition for years now. So Khan al-Ahmar is a small Palestinian village located in Area C of the occupied West Bank, which constitutes 60% of the occupied West Bank. And it's a community of about 200 Bedouins who come from the Jahalin tribe. And Khan al-Ahmar has been facing imminent demolition and forcible evacuation by Israel for the past several years, and the Israeli High Court in the past few months completely approved their imminent demolition, and this community could be forcibly displaced and evacuated, and their whole village demolished any time now. And even though there has been several delays in their demolition, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is constantly reaffirming that Khan al-Ahmar will be evacuated and that it's a court ruling and that this is Israeli policy and that this will be done. The location of Khan al-Ahmar is very important because it lies in the E1 area, which is this area east of Jerusalem that basically separates the northern and southern West Bank from each other. And Khan al-Ahmar is kind of this last hope. And if Khan al-Ahmar is evacuated, any kind of fantasy of a two-state solution would be over, because this is where Israel is planning to expand its mega settlements of Ma'ale Adumim and Kfar Adumim. So Khan al-Ahmar has been subject to harassment by settlers. Over the course of this legal battle, activists and journalists have been trying to sleep there sometimes to try to protect it. And I mean, eventually Israel wants to force Khan al-Ahmar's residents to move to an area called Al-Jabal West, which is located near a landfill of the Palestinian village of Abu Dis. And this is, of course, this would absolutely not work with the lifestyle of these villagers who live a nomadic lifestyle and need to live in an area that is not the landfill.
Something that I find quite interesting and that I've noticed in about Khan al-Ahmar is that because I cover the Israel lobby in the UK, you notice that even some of the people who are quite, like politicians who are quite actually pro-Israel on balance, and, you know, who do things like claim that the Labour Party is an anti-Semitic party and whatnot. There's one particularly nasty MP called Wes Streeting. Even some of them have been critical of the Israeli government for its treatment of Khan al-Ahmar because it's such an obvious act of racist ethnic cleansing. But, I mean, as you started to talk about, there's really no difference to how Israel treats Palestinians, or there's little difference anyway to how Israel treats Palestinians all over historic Palestine. So can you talk a bit about how Israel is also ethnically cleansing Palestinian citizens of Israel in the Nakab? And maybe talk a little bit about like the similarities and differences, if there are some, with Israeli ethnic cleansing in the West Bank.
Definitely. There's an area in the Nakab called Imr Hiran, where Israel has been trying to... that Israel has been trying to forcibly expel and demolish also for a long time. The Israeli government in April of last year tried to force residents to agree to their own expulsion. They want to resettle them in a town in the southern Nakab called Houda under threats of violence. So, I mean, there is definitely a connection. It all goes back to the root blatant racism of not wanting Palestinians to be in areas, especially ripe areas where Israel plans to expand its settlements make life so difficult for Palestinians that they either leave themselves or they are forcibly expelled. And Umm al-Hiran is a village of 350 people, and they're all citizens of Israel. And if the expulsion is carried out, all of them would be rendered homeless. What you said about the unusual condemnation that Khan al-Ahmar receives, or the unusual condemnation from European Union and UK leaders who criticize Israel's measures in Khan al-Ahmar. There's of course like a lot of verbal opposition, but apart from verbal opposition, EU states have failed to spell out any clear consequences for Israel if it defies these calls.
The electronic intifada.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Ed Weisbart, of the group Physicians for a National Health Program, who assesses the damage that will be done to the nation's healthcare system if a lawsuit backed by President Trump ends the Affordable Care Act. Tim Judson, Executive Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, who reflects on the 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island nuclear accident, the current state of the nuclear industry, and the growth of renewable energy alternatives. And Benny Nsumbu, a senior at Cooperative Arts and Humanities High School in New Haven, who explains why she and other students are advocating the inclusion of African American studies in Connecticut's public school curriculum. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Nations is examining a plan to relocate 100,000 Rohingya Muslims who fled mass violence in Myanmar 2 years ago to an isolated island on the Bay of Bengal called Bashan Char. The Bangladesh government says that moving Rohingya refugees to the muddy island will take pressure off overcrowded camps along its southern border, where almost 1 million Rohingya Muslims live in cramped tent cities. Human rights critics say the low-lying island is vulnerable to extreme flooding and typhoons, and so its use could trigger a new humanitarian crisis. The UN Refugee Agency has said nearly $1 billion was needed for the Rohingya in Bangladesh, but only a tiny fraction of those funds have been raised thus far. The plan to move the Rohingya to the island is said to be voluntary, which critics maintain will cause the plan to fail. Matthew Smith of the advocacy group Fortify Rights blasted the UN for endorsing the relocation plan. Smith told the British newspaper The Daily Telegraph, "Bashan Shah should be off the table. It's difficult at this stage to imagine any Rohingya volunteering to go, but coercion comes in many shapes and sizes." The US Supreme Court is contemplating hearing two cases that could further weaken union rights, collective bargaining, and the foundational principle of majority rule. In the 2018 Janus ruling, the court declared non-union workers were not required to contribute fees that pay for collective bargaining. In the case Uradnik v. Interfaculty Organization, a Minnesota professor, Kathleen Uradnik, is challenging the law that establishes the right of public employees to select an exclusive bargaining agent through a majority vote. Uradnik declares that this constitutes a violation of her free speech rights. Were the challenge to be affirmed by the Supreme Court, it would undermine unions' role as the exclusive bargaining agent for workers. In the second case, plaintiff Terry Bierman uses a similar argument to challenge a different Minnesota law that allows home care providers to select an exclusive representative. The American Prospect concludes that both Minnesota cases are very clearly part of a legal strategy long in the making. Should the court rule in favor of the plaintiffs in either case, it would be a major step toward undercutting workers' representational rights. If activist conservative justices find merit to the radical proposition that majoritarian democracy is unconstitutional in labor relations, it would be a blow not only to collective bargaining, but to American democracy itself. White supremacist Glendon Scott Crawford conspired to make a radiological death ray to target the local Muslim community in upstate New York. The weapon never worked, but in 2015, Crawford was convicted of attempting to use a weapon of mass destruction and is now serving a 30-year prison sentence. His co-defendant, Eric Fate, who had agreed to build a remote control for Crawford's weapon, was convicted of providing material support to terrorism, the first and only time federal prosecutors have used the material support law against a domestic extremist since the 9/11 attacks. In 1996, federal prosecutors used the law to go after members of the West Virginia Mountaineer Militia, charged with plotting to blow up an FBI building. According to the investigative news site The Intercept, the material support law has been commonly used against foreign terrorists in over 400 cases since 2001. Yet the same law is rarely used against white nationalists or other domestic terrorists. After the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. Justice Department created the National Security Division. From that point to today, all terrorism-related charges, including material support and the use of weapons of mass destruction, had to be approved by the National Security Division. After the DOJ's new bureaucracy was established, prosecutions for domestic terrorism using the material support law sharply declined. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
After congressional Republicans failed in their more than 70 attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, widely known as the ACA or Obamacare, President Trump has adopted a new strategy to end the now popular health insurance program. Trump directed the U.S. Justice Department on March 25th to file a legal brief supporting a lawsuit by conservative attorney generals, upheld by a lower federal court, that ruled the ACA was unconstitutional. If upheld by higher courts, ending the ACA would, by some estimates, eliminate 20 million Americans' health coverage. Dissolving the program would also dramatically reduce Medicaid coverage for millions more, and remove protections for some 50% of non-elderly Americans with pre-existing conditions. Although Mr. Trump campaigned for president, promising the country that he would replace Obamacare with something better, his administration put forward regulations that will increase premiums for sick Americans, allowed the sale of junk insurance plans that cover very little, and permitted state Medicaid programs to require beneficiaries to work, which has led to thousands of low-income citizens to lose their coverage. When asked in recent days what will replace the ACA if he wins his court case, Trump said a replacement plan won't be announced until after the 2020 election, and then only if Republicans win. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Ed Weisbart, chair of the Missouri chapter of the group Physicians for a National Health Program. Here, Dr. Weisbart assesses the damage that will be done to the nation's health care system if the lawsuit ending Obamacare is upheld.
If we reverse the law, we'll suddenly go back to these even worse insurance policies that have no limit on what, you know, they can start today. Today they can not restrict you by the dollar amount of your health care. They used to put $1 million limits on your care, which you could burn through in a few days, in a week or two in a hospital. They used to not cover things if you were sick beforehand. They used to not sell you insurance. They used to drop you when you got sick. There's a long list of things that the country as a whole has frankly started to take for granted now, because they are improvements. They are better than how things used to be, and it's hard to imagine losing them. But it is indeed the current administration's plan is to take away health care from tens of millions of people and make it worse for many of the rest of us. So it's a dreadful problem. We'll see worsening of diseases and other things like that. So it's a terrible strategy for them. On the other hand, they really have managed to put healthcare front and center in our debate again. So good for them, you know, renewed attention to this topic.
If upheld by the courts, as I understand it, dismantling Obamacare would not only throw the tens of millions of people off their ACA insurance plans, but would end Medicare expansion, would affect many millions more, repeal protections for people with pre-existing conditions, which pretty much affects almost everybody living here in America. And so we're talking about tens of millions, probably over 100 million people would be negatively affected by the repeal of Obamacare. Do I have that right?
No, I think that's exactly right. And even if you're not in one of the groups that are directly affected, having an insurance mechanism for these new people means that hospitals don't have to transfer the cost of that onto the insured, the otherwise insured. So it hasn't done nearly enough to control the cost of insurance, but it has done quite a bit. And you're right. We'll see, I don't know what the exact number is, but roughly 10 million people who are now covered by Medicaid who wouldn't be covered by Medicaid. And understand, most of the people that would be losing this are working people. They're people who work at jobs that are paid minimum wage or barely above minimum wage. They do work that we all rely upon, and it's obscene that they would not be able to have any form of health care. But that's what's going to happen if they do reverse it.
What is your response to the idea that President Trump says that he can work with the Democratic newly controlled House of Representatives and the Senate to come up with a better plan than Obamacare?
I would love that to happen. I have no evidence to base that hope on, but I would love that to happen. His party has had, 9 years now since the passage of the 10 years since the passage of the Affordable Care Act to recommend a substitute for the Affordable Care Act. And the reason they can't come up with a better substitute is because the ideas behind the Affordable Care Act originated in their party. They essentially wrote it a long time ago, and it was their best idea that they could come up with, and they don't have anything else. They have not proposed anything else, despite 10 years of talking about repeal and replace. So if Trump decided that he wanted to work with the Democratic Party to move forward on a better solution, I know exactly what that solution should be. It would be improved Medicare for all. I have no confidence that he would go down that road, but you know, the scenario you're painting of what if Trump wanted to work with us, bring it on. I'd be delighted.
Dr. Weisbart, one last question. We only have about a minute or two left.
What do you feel the biggest obstacle is in the United States to establishing a single-payer Medicare for All type system?
Our democracy is on the ropes. We have once again allowed largely moneyed interests to corrupt the way our campaign finance system works. And so our legislators are having to compete for the best campaign finance sources they can get. And they follow the money and do what the big moneyed interests say. We have been through this before. Teddy Roosevelt dealt with it. Every 20 to 40 years, our country goes through having to rescue democracy, and we are down on the ropes again with this. But the good news is healthcare is such an important issue to everyone that I believe people understanding how important healthcare is, how at risk their healthcare is, and how linked that risk is to democracy's survival, I think we can use healthcare to galvanize the rebirth of our democracy in a good way.
That was Dr. Ed Weisbart, chair of the Missouri chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. Learn more about PNHP and their support for establishing a Medicare for All healthcare system in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. March 28th marked the 40th anniversary of the accident at Three Mile Island Nuclear Plant near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the worst accident at a commercial nuclear power plant in the nation's history. A combination of flawed plant design, equipment malfunction, and human error led to a loss of cooling water that resulted in the partial meltdown of the plant's Unit 2 reactor. Although no official evacuation of the area was ordered by the state, then-Governor Dick Thornburg suggested that pregnant women and families with young children leave. Decades later, epidemiological health studies suggest higher rates of cancer among area residents where nuclear radiation was released into the atmosphere. The 1979 accident at TMI dramatically derailed what had, until then, been dramatic growth by the nuclear industry. 51 U.S. reactors were canceled between 1980 and 1984, and no new nuclear reactors were authorized to be built until 2012. Subsequent major disasters at nuclear power plants at Russia's Chernobyl reactor in 1986 and Japan's Fukushima nuclear power station in 2011 have justifiably triggered public opposition to nuclear power worldwide. As a share of domestic energy production, nuclear power provided just under 20% of U.S. electrical generation in 2018. By comparison, over the past 10 years, renewable energy sources, including wind, solar, and hydropower, nearly doubled their share, growing from 9.25% to almost 18% last year. Your reporter spoke with Tim Judson, executive director with the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Here he reflects on the 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island nuclear accident, the current state of the nuclear industry, and renewable energy sources, which are overtaking nuclear power.
You know, it's really important that we talk about what happened at Three Mile Island, you know, even 40 years later, in part because what happened that day has been misconstrued and misreported and downplayed and covered up for the last 40 years. Starting on the day of the accident or the disaster itself, I actually don't say accident, even though that's the term that's usually used, because, you know, what happened at Three Mile Island was not an accident. It was entirely predictable. You know, accident sort of implies, you know, something like a tree blowing over and landing on your car. This was an industrial disaster of a massive scale. There were lots of warning signs and precautions that could have been taken to avoid it and weren't, you know, and it's important to acknowledge that people had responsibility for that. So at Three Mile Island on March 28th, 1979, you had what could have been a fairly benign malfunction where you had a leak in a coolant line that shut down the main coolant pumps to the reactor. That triggered a series of events, all of which went badly. The operators misinterpreted some of the alarms and the signals and the gauges that they were reading. Other systems ended up malfunctioning. But what you had was very rapidly, within actually a minute, you had the conditions for a reactor accident or reactor disaster already taking shape. And so within an hour, basically, of this coolant pump failing, they were losing hundreds of thousands of gallons of water from the reactor being blown out as steam. And that water started to collect and be pumped into an auxiliary building where the intensely radioactive gases that were in that water started to leak to the environment. And the reactor operators didn't realize any of this was happening for over 2 hours. And so by the time they realized that, there was essentially a full-scale nuclear meltdown already underway. Within a few hours later, by that afternoon, there was actually a hydrogen explosion within the reactor building that released large amounts of radiation into the surrounding environment. And by that point, there was virtually no way to contain the radiation that was being released by the reactor.
Tib, what was the effect on the population after decades have gone by? What have long-term studies shown if there's been any effect of that radiation on people's health?
Yeah, the studies that have been done have shown that there's actually been a really significant increase in cancers and other diseases in the communities near Three Mile Island. One of the things that's important to recognize is the official government studies, you know, tend to look in the wrong places to find these problems. It wasn't until the 1990s that an epidemiologist did a study of the effects of the accident that looked at what really happened on that day. What was going on in the, you know, weather-wise in the days around the time of the disaster was that there was an air inversion, a temperature inversion over the Susquehanna River Valley area where Three Mile Island was located. And that trapped the air in the valley from getting over the sides of the hills and into the surrounding area. So basically the radiation that was released from Three Mile Island mostly stayed along the river up and down from where Three Mile Island sits. And if you look at those areas, you find that you find cancers have increased by 2 to 3 times what the normal levels are. So the communities around Three Mile Island have really suffered, due to the releases of radiation during the disaster.
Thank you for that, Tim. Tell us generally what the status of renewable energy sources are here in the United States, sources like wind and solar as it compares to nuclear power right now.
Sure. Well, wind and solar, really are the future, and they're here. And the cost and the quality of the technology with renewable energy generally, but especially with wind and solar, has really just exploded in the last 10 years. Solar now costs, I think, more than 80% less than it did 10 years ago. Wind power is on the order of 40 to 50% cheaper than it was 10 years ago. Wind and solar are now basically dollar for dollar the most cost-effective forms of generating electricity that we have, even more so than natural gas, which has been, which has really been, kind of held up as the cheap new energy source. But now it's wind and solar. The part of the trouble is that the utility industry and the fossil fuel and nuclear industries in particular have been trying to prevent renewable energy from really taking off in the U.S. because it really challenges, their core businesses. So you have, places in the country where renewables have been really encouraged and allowed to take off, and not necessarily in blue states, like California, but also in Texas and Kansas and Iowa, where, renewables are growing faster than the nuclear power ever has or ever could probably. And, we're really in a position where, if you look at what happens when states, and local governments do things to encourage renewable energy, do the right things to encourage renewable energy, that we could really have a clean energy revolution taking shape in this country within a few years.
That was Tim Judson, Executive Director with the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. For more information on the long-term effects of the accident at Three Mile Island and the state of the nuclear power industry, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Some Connecticut legislators have introduced bills that would require the teaching of African American or African American and Latinx history in the state's public schools. The proposed legislation, House Bill 7082, is called an act concerning the inclusion of African American studies in the public school curriculum. At the same time, a group of high school students from several New Haven public schools have been working on establishing an African American history curriculum into the local school system as an elective course. That group, Students for Educational Justice, held meetings with some of the bill's legislative sponsors, and a dozen of them testified at a public hearing in March. The students want any bill that's passed to include the study of race and racism to prevent what they call a fun fact session about famous Black Americans. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Benny Nsumbu, a senior at Cooperative Arts and Humanities High School in New Haven. Here she talks about the amendments they want added to House Bill 7082, the efforts they've undertaken to promote passage, and why they want the curriculum to specifically address the experience of African Americans.
Our biggest fear is that it'll turn into just another fun fact session about Black history and won't really talk about race and racism and like why there's like the racial disparities in America.
So the bill in the legislature basically just says that African American history must be taught in Connecticut schools, but gives no specifics. Is that right?
Yes. So that's the bill before our amendments. The reason why we really wanted to get our amendments in there is because just the way that it's written, it doesn't have substance to it. It doesn't really, there's no meat to it. There's nothing that's going to make it effective and sufficient, you know, in schools and really give kids material that they need to understand this.
So what would your group's amendments do?
So one of our amendments is to add a history of race and racism to the title of the bill, or like the title of the content that will be given to students, because the title of this African American history allows for these people, schools, to really only talk about the basics, which is like slavery, the civil rights movement, you know, just shouting, giving names to students and not really going deep into why those things happen and how they're still affecting students or people today. The requirement of teachers to get anti-racial bias training. We did a lot of research before we started this campaign. We met with a bunch of people, principals, teachers, and talked, and we realized that like teachers really weren't getting proper training, and even if they weren't getting training at all. And if they were, it was not sufficient. And so we wanted to make it required, like in this as a law, that teachers would have to get this training, especially if they were going to teach this content. So that's one of our amendments. And then another one was to add create a committee that would oversee the implementation of this content, this course, into schools, and making sure that it's done well. And we would make it so that like the people on the committee would be reflective of the community. We would have students on there, experts on race, teachers, everyone. The people that would have the knowledge and be the most affected by this law. We wanted to get a committee in there, especially since we weren't confident that the systems in place would make sure that this is done well. We wanted to make sure it would be done well, and we felt that creating a separate committee to specifically oversee this would do it well.
Do the bill's sponsors support your amendments?
So we've talked to Representative Gibson and met with him, and we went over our amendments and the bill the way that it's written, and we were trying to make sure that the amendments were written in a way that, you know, pleased him and would please the legislators that would have to vote on this, because we didn't want it to be so confrontational that like they would vote against it. He seemed like he accepted it, and right now we're just waiting.
I know that some members of your group testified that you wanted to just specify teaching of African American history and race and racism as it relates to African Americans, but doesn't the bill as of now include Latinx studies as well?
So right now there are two bills. There's HB 7082, which is an act for the inclusion of African American studies in Connecticut public schools, and then there's HB 7083, which is for the inclusion of Puerto Rican and Latin American studies in public schools, in Connecticut public schools. We don't want it just to turn into ethnic studies, which really does lump all of minorities in America together. It waters down the true story of African Americans, which we feel like you can't talk about other races or the histories of other peoples in America, like Black, Latinx people, or Asian Americans, without talking about the history of African Americans, which is very unique because they built this country, and it also goes into like anti-blackness. They can't be anything else because of the color of their skin. And one of our fears is that like with the existence of these two bills, that it'll be grouped into ethnic studies. And we don't want want it to be ethnic studies group. We wanted to talk about race and racism. To understand race and racism, you have to learn the history of African Americans.
That was Benny Nsumbu with Students for Educational Justice. Learn more about the students' campaign for inclusion of African American history in the Connecticut Public School curriculum by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRGU in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, FRSC in Santa Cruz, California, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Rapping with a rapper. For the last few years, in light of the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement and the arresting images from Ferguson, Missouri, rappers have created songs that rap not about wealth or sex, but about the wave of repression and resistance experienced by young Black people. Songs like Hands Up by Uncle Murda, Soul Survivor by Young Jeezy and Akon, Cop Skit by Black Rob, and Stay Woke by Meek Mill could be headlines from today's newspapers. They're sonic musical signs of the times, of times that are not well in America. A rapper called Young Chris has been inspired by the rapper Meek Mill to join the call for an end to mass incarceration and has even used some audio by me to make his points. Young Chris, speaking of Meek and other influences, explains diving into this arena. However, what he is doing has educated me. My best man, Bird, is currently serving a sentence of life without possibility of parole for something he didn't do. So that was all the influence I really needed to speak on these matters. I feel like I had to become his voice, along with many others that are facing a similar situation. Free Bird. I asked Young Chris why so many rappers refuse to address such issues in their work. Young Chris, in my opinion, I don't think they're outright refusing to discuss these serious matters. They're just sleep because it didn't hit home. I once was sleep until injustice had blanketed my best man. We as a community have to do better. I mentioned to young Chris seeing Meek speak out against mass incarceration on the nationally syndicated show Ellen. Young Chris responded, that was big to get his story out on Ellen. We need as much attention to the injustices that has riddled our brown and black communities, along with the white underprivileged, for years. I've known Meek since he was a young teenager, and I've always felt he was special. If you're a hip-hop head, you may remember the duo known as Young Guns, which did a piece called Can't Stop, Won't Stop, over a bed played by Heavy D called Overweight Lovers in the House. The song, recorded by Rockefeller Records, hit number 10 on the Billboard charts and ran for 29 weeks. Well, Young Chris was half of Young Guns, with Hanif Neef Muhammad as the other half. His message for hip-hop? We just have to speak for the voiceless, Young Chris said, adding, speak up and speak out. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Trump in triumph. The news that Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller would return no additional indictments and no charges of wrongdoing by incumbent President Donald Trump has hit Washington like a thunderclap. Leading Democratic politicians are in a state of shock, as if they never considered the possibility of such an outcome. Shock and awe abound. Dems, who learned their politics and political classes in college, seemingly never learned the true role of the FBI, which showed in the woeful history of the 1960s that were profoundly political and agents of the imperial executive, as shown by the monstrous attacks on Dr. Martin Luther King, the Black Panthers, and activists from a score of social change groups. They rarely, if ever, attacked the wealthy and powerful. And Trump, equipped with a weapon no president has ever seen before, blasted his way out of what seemed like an insurmountable trap, sending shockwaves once again throughout the system. That weapon? Twitter. With over 50 million recipients, changed the dynamics between the accused and the accuser. For the FBI was formed to serve the imperial executive, not to oppose it. Like a corpulent Roman emperor, Trump plays on the links, while the case against him sinks beneath the green. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Venezuela again. Several years ago, during the early days of Hugo Chavez's presidency, U.S. forces supported a coup attempt against him, and the barrios of Caracas exploded in support for the former military officer. The people of the capital came forth demanding his immediate release, and Chavez was released. The Americans, of course, denied involvement, but everyone knows otherwise. Latin America has seen the bloody paws of the American empire. And they've seen it for the better part of a century, and it has never been pretty. More recently, the New York Times has reported that the Trump administration has been in contact with Venezuelan generals, and they try to get them to betray their country's government. The White House denied it, but everyone knows otherwise. Maduro, Venezuela's elected president, is at heart a Chavista, for he admired his old boss, President Hugo Chavez, and he cherishes his memory. Don't believe for a moment claims that the U.S. government cares about the Venezuelan people, for we need look no further than America's colony called Puerto Rico. After hurricanes and storms ravaged the island, the White House called them ingrates after they demanded help from their brother Americans. Trump threw paper towels at them. This is true. And he denied them any kind of real support. They were left to swim or drown in the face of a natural catastrophe. May I remind you that Puerto Ricans are Americans, and American citizens, no less. No matter, for when they needed help the most, they found they were on their own. You think they care about Venezuelans when they don't give a damn about Puerto Ricans? Does that make sense? A leopard, they say, cannot change its spots. An empire cannot change its ways. Thank you all. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
What were the real reasons for the creation of NATO? Why would an ostensibly defensive military body be expanding its theater of operations beyond the North Atlantic region and increasing its expenditures nearly three decades after the collapse of the Soviet Union? Was NATO the inevitable outcome of three decades of Western imperialist aggression? Is there a fundamental difference between Western interference in the Global South countries and that of the Russians and Chinese? On this week's Global Research News Hour, on the occasion of a week marking the 70th anniversary of the signing of the North Atlantic Treaty, we take a closer look at this hostile military alliance and how it and the Western imperialist impulse has impacted global economics and global affairs. Our guests for the hour are award-winning geopolitical analyst, scholar, and author Mahdi Darius Nazimroya, and journalist, novelist, and war correspondent Andrei Vilchik. On this week's program, NATO at 70, Global Enforcers of Western Imperialism. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 5th, 2019. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Most Venezuelans want Bolivarian social democracy preserved and protected. They oppose foreign intervention in any form, overwhelmingly against it militarily. On Monday, Venezuelan Chief Supreme Court Justice Michel Moreno called on the nation's Constituent Assembly to strip Guaido of parliamentary immunity for flouting a high court order banning his foreign travel without court permission, illicit financial activities, inciting street violence, and other offenses. Established by national referendum to revise or rewrite Venezuela's constitution, restore and maintain order, as well as serving everyone in the country equitably, the Constituent Assembly is the Bolivarian Republic's highest legal authority. According to Article 349 of Venezuela's constitution, no other power can, quote, in any way impede the decisions of the National Constituent Assembly, unquote. Not the President, National Assembly legislators, and Supreme Court justices. That comes from the article, U.S. Puppet Guaido Stripped of Immunity, by Stephen Lendman, posted April 3rd. Even between Merkel and Macron, there seems to be notable friction surrounding energy independence. However, in spite of these apparent divergences, the prevailing theme in the final analysis is that of wishing to escape Washington's suffocating dominance in favor of a greater participation in the concept of a multipolar world. No European capital, whether it be Paris, Rome, Berlin, or London, intends to break the Atlantic Pact with Washington. This is confirmed at every possible formal occasion. However, as Beijing becomes more and more central to questions concerning technology or the supply of liquid capital for investments or business expansion, the changes to the global order seem unstoppable. That comes from the article, Belt and Road Initiative in Full Swing in Europe, by Federico Pieraccini, posted April 3rd, originally published at Strategic Culture Foundation. According to the state's website, the Riot Boosting Act is a result of Governor Kristi Noem's discussions with TransCanada, the company that is set to build and operate the Keystone XL pipeline, and other stakeholders. Notably, the state did not meet with Native American tribes or environmental groups. This comes across loud and clear in the final law, which not only gives the state the authority to sue anti-pipeline groups and activists, but also gives third parties, including TransCanada, the ability to join in. Further, the money seized from protesters through these lawsuits can be used to fund the very thing they are protesting, thereby giving the company an added financial incentive to go after pipeline protesters. If this attack on protest sounds eerily familiar, that's because it is. That comes from the article, The South Dakota legislature has invented a new legal term to target pipeline protesters, by Andrew Malone and Vera Eidelman, posted April 3rd, originally published on the ACLU's website. But there is something fishy here. If the 400-page report by the Department of Justice's special counsel Robert Mueller about Donald Trump cheating and obstructing justice in his relations with Russia really does contain positive conclusions about the current occupant of the White House, his family, and associates, don't you think the tandem Trump-Barr would have rushed to make it public? At the very least, wouldn't they have delivered copies of the full report to Congress? Why are they willing to fight to keep it secret from the elected Congress? The only logical answer is that the complete Mueller report contains very damaging material about Trump, his family, and his administration, and William Barr does not want Americans to see it. That comes from the article, Trump Barr's Manipulation of the Special Counsel Robert Mueller Report of March 22, 2019, The Political Cover-Up of the Century, by Professor Rodrigue Tremblay, posted April 2nd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Seventy years ago, on April 4th, 1949, Canada, the United States, and 10 European nations signed the North Atlantic Treaty, otherwise known as the Washington Treaty, which cleared the legal path for the historic military alliance known as NATO. While NATO foreign ministers gather in Washington this week, to commemorate the occasion and set the agenda going into the future, there's been concern and criticism from citizens within and outside NATO countries as to what the NATO agenda is really all about. Is it about keeping the peace, or is it a force of aggression in the service of economic elites? To try to address some of those concerns, we're joined by Mahdi Nazemroya, an award-winning author and geopolitical analyst. Mahdi Darius Nazemroya is the author of The Globalization of NATO by Clarity Press. He's also contributed to several other books ranging from cultural critique to international relations. He's a sociologist and research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization. Welcome back to the show, Mahdi.
Thank you for having me.
In your estimation, what were the true reasons for creating NATO?
What happened towards the end of World War II, after 1945, is that the populations in Western European countries were radicalized to an extent and felt disenfranchised to an extent, and also were fed up with the status quo that had taken them into the war. They had also, when I meant by the word radicalized, I mean that they have paradigm shifts in the way governance should take place in their Western European states and societies. So, for example, in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, the UK, what happened was many of the people were drifting towards these leftist ideas of socialism, either as socialists, social democrats, and communists included in that category. So they had drifted towards these perspectives, and the United States did not want, as well as the elites in these Western European countries, didn't want these countries to go in that direction. It's not just a matter of ideology. At the same time, the United States and Western European elites in countries like Britain and France also were thinking in context of geopolitics. So geopolitically speaking, they also didn't want these countries to orbit towards the Soviet Union, towards Moscow. So this was one of the reasons the United States took the opportunity to help weave the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which brought together Canada, the United States, and a few Western European countries such as Belgium, the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg, Britain, France. So what happened is, the United States basically used the North Atlantic Treaty, or the Washington Treaty, to legitimize its post-1945 occupation of Western Europe. Since NATO was created, of course, there's an expansion process that took place. There's been over five expansions throughout the years since 1945, and so the alliance basically started expanding eastward from its original position in Western Europe.
There's also been sister organizations like CETO in the southeast and CENTO in the Middle East. Can you maybe is that sort of an expansion of this geopolitical dynamic that you're mentioning?
Well, during the Cold War, the United States, the Atlanticists in the United States, or the foreign policy elite, the foreign policy mandarins, they were thinking of containment. This containment theory was based on the U.S. perspective before the end of World War II. So the perspective was that the United States needs to place itself within Europe and Asia. And the reason was that the United States, under theories such as Nicholas Spykman, the Dutch-American scholar's theory of the Rimland, which is premised off the earlier theories of Mackinder's heartland in Europe and Asia, or Eurasia, because they're really physically one continent. Europe and Asia are really one continent. It's only politically that we consider them two separate continents. So I'll use the term Eurasia now. They believe that the United States needs to place itself physically in Eurasia. So NATO is actually one of those things. So you have these American bases in Germany, Italy that popped up, Britain after World War II. And again, as I said, it's to legitimize the post-1945 U.S. occupation of European territories after the war, because the United States was one of the main victors. So to follow on this theory, a chain of alliances was created around the United States, which encircled the Soviet Union and later encircled what is to be the People's Republic of China, because in the late 1950s, Chairman Mao and the Communist Party of China take over, and China becomes the People's Republic of China, and the nationalists are sent to Taiwan. And so CETO, which is the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, was made to encircle China. Now, CENTO, which is the Central Treaty Organization, it was also called the Middle East. It had another name based on the Middle East, also called the Baghdad Pact, because the agreement was signed in Baghdad. Had the United States as an associate member, but was consisted of Britain, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Pakistan. So, that was made to create a barrier to the Soviet Union in West Asia, basically. And if you look at NATO, CENTO, and CETO, they have several common members. For example, France and Pakistan were both members of the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization. While France was also a member of NATO, and Pakistan was a member of CENTO, the Central Treaty Organization. The United Kingdom was a member of all three alliances. Turkey was a member of the Central Treaty Organization and a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So you can see that these three alliances created... encircled two of the United States' main rivals during the Cold War period. Again, the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China, the two red giants of Eurasia.
There's also the aspect of the way NATO seems to enforce certain kinds of economic modes of organization, sort of keeping certain countries in line with the Bretton Woods Washington consensus and so on. Could you speak to maybe some examples of how that's played out?
Well, when NATO was expanding in Europe at the end of the Cold War, one of their goals was market democracy, just a new term for capitalism and for the Washington consensus. I would say that we could characterize NATO as expansion of the United States' economic sphere. I would actually even point out today in contemporary times, in the years 2018 and 2019, it has become even more clear that economics is tied to the agenda, because the United States is heavily pressuring its allies under the Trump administration to buy American weapons. And when President Donald Trump and his administration in Washington demand that other NATO allies of the United States spend more on spend more for NATO, have higher budgets, what the one of the main things they are saying is you have to buy more weapons from the United States' military-industrial complex. So buy more jets from us, buy more Patriot missiles from us, buy more military hardware from us, and our big military corporations. So that's one of the economic angles for sure.
So what do you make of this decision by Turkey recently to want to purchase Russian S-400 anti-missile system rather than the Patriots from the U.S.? That seems to be – Turkey is a NATO ally. And so what does that speak to in terms of that modus operandi of NATO?
Well, I would point out two things. First, I'd like just contextually let the audience know that Turkey is one of the major NATO allies. It's one of the largest and strongest military forces within the alliance. So that's the first thing. But in terms of the S-400 deal between Moscow and Ankara, between the Turkish and Russian governments, I would point out, first of all, that Turkey is not the first NATO country to have the S-400. Some other NATO members have it. Then, at the same time, I would point out that Turkey is not the first NATO member to also buy military hardware from the Russians at all. So there's a bit of politics tied to this, and of course, going back to the economics, the United States wants to up its sales of military hardware, and that's why it wants Turkey to buy from the United States instead of from Russia. It doesn't want any momentum to be given to a program where the Russian military industrial complex, specifically the Russian arms companies, are getting any more sales in the world. They're global competitors in that perspective. But another thing I want to point out is increasingly we see the United States doesn't believe any of its own jargon, any of its own statements through its actions, we can see this, about any fair and free competition. So all those type of capitalist statements about free and fair competition, when it comes down to it, the United States doesn't believe that. It doesn't believe free and fair competition at all. It actually believes in using politics and governance and demands to have unequal advantage. So that's what the United States has been doing, even with non-NATO members. So, for example, non-NATO countries like Iraq wanted to buy helicopters and Afghanistan from Russia. The United States, as much as it could, obscured this. So the United States increasingly is showing the rest of the world. I mean, there's many examples of this now, that it does not believe even fair competition at all, like fair and free competition. It believes in actually having unfair advantages. And in fact, the trade war with China and the unilateralist steps being taken by the Trump administration actually prove this. The trade agreements it wants to have are unfair, and that's why the United States wants to walk out on many of the multilateral trade agreements it set up itself, because other countries have learned to play the game, and it wants to renegotiate all types of international, multilateral, or even bilateral trade agreements so it can press a reset button with giving itself new unfair advantages. And that's why in the World Trade Center, the United States has blocked judges from coming in to rule on whether the Chinese, U.S., the Sino-American trade disagreement. They've actually blocked, judges from ruling on it. They've been and they've said if they rule against us at the time, I'm speaking about last year, we'll leave the World Trade Organization. In fact, they've said that the tariffs and their arguments, the way they rationalize it with the World Trade Organization, is to say that the Chinese are socialist and we're going to keep the tariffs. We're going to keep tariffs on them. And the European Union has also used this. And this is why they've used this to maintain a level of tariffs. Because if they drop the tariffs under the agreements of the World Trade Organization they have with China, many of their domestic corporations will be swept because of Chinese goods coming into the country, into the markets, which are much cheaper, sometimes better, not all the time, or of equal quality, but again, cheaper. And they would be American corporations, as well as corporations in the EU, would more or less suffer and eventually go bankrupt because they can't compete against the Chinese.
Mahdi, returning the focus to NATO, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the idea that that Soviet Union or Russia was a credible threat, that whole rationale was gone, and they switched the focus to humanitarian intervention. And so we had that NATO assault on Yugoslavia in 1999, where basically they were using these elite weapons, weapons that were conceived and sold and marketed as useful against the Soviets, the B-2 bomber and depleted uranium, graphite bombs and other such things and sophisticated weaponry. And they're using it ostensibly to stop ethnic cleansing, kind of like using dynamite to kill a mosquito. What do you think of this idea that as a motivation that to keep the defense industry happy, you needed to keep priming that pump of military investment in these defense contracts, that you need to have some kind of a rationale that's going to justify. Because the B-2 bomber, for instance, I don't think that was conceived to be used against, to stop the ethnic cleansing. So what about that kind of cynical aspect of continuing the invest and maintaining investment in the defense industry?
So two things we should mention, I think, that are key. One is the militarization of other aspects of international relations and, I guess, daily life in other countries. That's what took place, is militarization in that context. The other one was new pretext to continue military operations. So humanitarian intervention, peacekeeping, also international policing and taxing, for example, carrying African Union troops into countries like Sudan, international policing such as in Eastern Europe, air marshaling the air, anti-piracy work, such as off the coast of Africa and in the Gulf of Aden between Yemen and Somalia. And also, I should mention very importantly, NATO left its original self-imposed or self-described sphere of responsibility, which was basically Europe and the North Atlantic. So in the 1990s, when the United States went into Iraq to supposedly liberate Kuwait, it actually used NATO tactics, and its allies worked within the framework of what a NATO offensive would be. And that's when policy analysts and military specialists in the United States' eyes opened, and they were looking at Yugoslavia eventually. And I should mention that Yugoslavia was an independent country outside of the orbit of the United States, as well as even the Soviet Union, which, as an independent actor, had left an alternative in Europe. So disintegrating it was very desired. And before the events that took place in the former Yugoslavia, U.S. policy analysts had already outlined how the country needs to be taken apart and how the United States cannot invade immediately because they would unite all the people of the former Yugoslavia, regardless of what their ethnicity was, whether they were Slovenians, Croats, Bosniaks, Serbs, Montenegrins or Macedonians or Albanians. They would be united, and they would be against any large military invasion of the country. Okay. So, I mean, the U.S. had a hand in helping disintegrate that country, and we can see what happened in countries like Bosnia, where the actual functional
de jure legal head of the country, or sorry, I would say also de facto, as well as de jure, was the high representative from the European Union. The deputy would be appointed from the United States. The head of the Bosnian bank by law in Bosnia had to be a non-Bosnian picked by the European Union and the United States. So, I mean, that's a colony, basically. Yeah. You know, it basically used humanitarian pretext to gut the former Yugoslavia. So the Federation of the Southern Slavs was gutted. And from there on, we see how humanitarian intervention has really been pushed forward by NATO. So they've tried to apply it in Sudan. They've also used it. The last example is in 2011 in the Libyan Arab Jamhuria, where regime change took place in Tripoli against the government of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi.
Yeah. Mahdi, I think we're going to have to leave it there, but I thank you once again. It's great to have you on the show and look forward to more of your articles. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with a sociologist and research associate with the Center for Research on Globalization and the author of The Globalization of NATO, Mahdi Darius Nazemroya. He joined us from Toronto. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. Born in Leningrad, what is now referred to as St. Petersburg, Andrei Vulchik is a philosopher, novelist, filmmaker, and investigative journalist. He grew up in the former Czechoslovakia and has since visited 145 countries. His books and films, which include the 2015 volume Exposing the Lies of Empire, generally center on Western imperialism and Western expansionism, and their adverse effects on domestic populations around the world. Vulchik presently resides in East Asia and the Middle East. He visited the cities of Regina and Winnipeg in Canada on the week corresponding with the 70th anniversary of NATO, where he spoke at anti-NATO events hosted by local peace groups. I had a chance to interview Mr. Vulchik in person during a car ride to Winnipeg's Richardson International Airport and probe his views about NATO and about Western imperialist tradition generally. Just a warning to listeners, there are some graphic descriptions in the following segment. Listener discretion is advised. But given that, you know, there's been that history of Western empire and a resistance, was NATO an inevitable, or something like it, inevitable in that context, or was it some sort of an accident of history? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, actually, no accident of history. What happened is that there were several imperialist powers after the Second World War, and they just consolidated into this North Atlantic Treaty, which was at the beginning supposed to so-called protect the West and the rest of the world, as they were calling it, free world against us bad guys, the Soviets, the Eastern Communist bloc. And of course, it was never supposed to be a defensive coalition. It was acting as extremely aggressive organization, and it is acting as such until now. Although Soviet Union is no more, I think temporarily it's no more. The NATO still exists, and it intimidates countries. It bullies countries, it overthrows governments, and it also occupies several previously proud and independent nations.
Now, I know that you were born in Leningrad, what's now called St. Petersburg. You grew up in Czechoslovakia, and you've written in your book Exposing the Lies of Empire about this tendency of a lot of these countries that have been exposed to you know, imperial oppression, and yet they seem to admire and even emulate these Western powers. You yourself grew up looking up to the West. So, if I may, how do you understand that? What is your understanding of this tendency for people under the yoke to lick the hand that beats them?
Well, I recently wrote an essay on this topic, and it is actually a very dangerous trend. I see it everywhere in the world, and I lived on all continents of the world, even continents that were absolutely devastated by the West, like Africa. The trend is that many people in previously occupied nations or nations that are until now could be described as client states have some soft spot at the best and or are fully submissive at worst to the Western culture, which devastated them for so many decades and centuries. Correctly, you pointed out, I was born in Leningrad. I lived there for some time as a child, but then I grew up in Czechoslovakia, which used to be Czechoslovakia, and now it's Czech Republic. We were under constant bombardment of the Western media. There was BBC, there was Voice of America, there was Radio Free Europe, in all imaginable local languages, Czech, Russian, of course, English. There were German television stations beaming from across the border from Bavaria because I was growing up in Pilsen, which was literally 50 kilometers from the border. So what they created was this atmosphere that in order to be young and cool and really up to the times, you had to follow Western trends. You had to consider communism and non-Western way of life as boring. Many people literally sold the ideas of internationalism for a pair of designer jeans. And it was unfortunately happening also in the Soviet Union at the end of the era during the Gorbachev period. People were totally hooked on the Western propaganda. They were literally spitting at their soldiers who went to perform their internationalist duty in Afghanistan. So the Western media has tremendous impact on lives of the people. It actually, the Western propaganda, not only media, because propaganda includes both media and so-called academia or education system. So unfortunately, this is how both Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia decomposed, because or Eastern Bloc decomposed under the tremendous pressure of the Western propaganda. That's why, if we are going to ever, if we are really fighting against Western imperialism, the main front is ideological front.
That speaks to this idea of storytelling, the stories that we tell that informs our identity and informs our sense of community and the nation. Could you maybe speak about maybe some of the more profound examples of that replacement that takes place that's really working to undermine that tendency to be able to resist that foreign control?
Well, the stories are integral part of the human both memory and also development. Locally grown stories and locally created narrative is one of the best ways how to resist implanted stories and implanted narrative from the West. What is West really trying to do? It's trying to make everything uniformed, and uniformed according to its own gospel. So the entire world is supposed to see what is occurring on all continents through the eyes of the Western culture and the Western propaganda. So to resist this, we have to read our own writers, we have to create alternative media, we have to describe the world from our own perspective. And that's actually what is happening. That's why I'm very optimistic, because I think that this uniformed Western narrative is dying, because people start to wake up in Russia, in China, in many parts of Asia and Middle East, Africa, Latin America. They are talking their own, they're speaking their own language, and in the meantime, they're interacting between each other, this famous South-South cooperation. So before, everything had to go through the centers of, through the hubs like London, New York, Paris, Miami, Los Angeles. This is changing. People do start to interact, and there is a much greater exchange of ideas directly between, let's say, China and Africa, Russia and the Middle East. So I'm very optimistic. This is part of the resistance, and it is very successful resistance.
Now, there are modes of asserting imperial control that are kind of sophisticated, and it seems to me that one of them is the ability to use ethnic identities as ways of dividing. We saw that happening in the former Yugoslavia, for example. Could you maybe give us a little bit more of your own insights into how that mechanism is being used to further the aims of empire?
Yes, the ethnics and religion. Let's not forget religions. And these are two weapons that the West is using. Basically, when it comes to ethnicity, it's an old divide and rule British concept. And we saw it at the end of British rule in subcontinent with horrible, of course, consequences. Partition and so on. But it's used everywhere else where the empire gets involved. Religion is even more powerful sort. The West is basically creating and upholding the most extreme types of religions, and it injects religions places which are supposed to be destabilized. We saw it in Afghanistan. We see it now almost everywhere in the world. For instance, Syria used to be a secular country, but because of the allies of the West, Qataris, Saudis, and to some extent Turks, actually injected jihadi cadres to this secular nation. Syria changed dramatically during the civil war, and now it has nothing to do with some kind of opposition against Assad. It's basically fighting terrorism. Syria is fighting terrorism that was implanted by the West, which claims to be secular. We see this spread of extreme religious forms in many places of Southeast Asia, Africa, and elsewhere. And it can be Islam, but it can also be Christianity, extreme forms of Christianity, like in Congo, DRC, or it can be extreme Buddhism. We see this divisive policy applied to almost every nation that the West wants to antagonize or which it occupies, which leads to perpetual wars, perpetual conflicts. Afghanistan, the country which was moving into the secular direction under Soviet era and also under Dr. Najibullah, is now one of the most extremist countries on earth. Libya, again, relatively pan-African and relatively secular, is now torn by religious strifes. So almost anywhere where the West comes, it leaves this leaves divisions, both ethnic and especially religious.
Now, my reading of what I've heard from you thus far is that you just mentioned Pan-Africanism and these sorts of movements and ideological alternatives to this sort of Western style capitalism that's been put in place as essentially the driving force behind a lot of these invasions. And you seem to be more dismissive of issues around oil and gas, not to say that they're completely aside, but the Carter Doctrine states that oil is an important source of strategic strength. If you want to have an effective military, you got to be able to control the oil. So, you know, in light of those realities, do you have occasion to maybe reconsider that these basic strategic incentives are a significant factor as well?
Oil was always a significant factor. Other natural resources were as well. That's why places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, had been plundered on behalf of the Western Empire by Rwanda and Uganda. That's why Indonesia experienced this horrible coup in 1965. But what I'm saying in much of my writing is that the West reached an extremely fundamentalist level culturally. It believes in its own exceptionalism. It's looking at the world as something that has to be fully controlled. It is not only politically, it's also ideologically and culturally and in many other ways. Supply of oil is already secured. Trillions of dollars are being made by individuals and by capitalist companies in the West. So it is not anymore only about natural resources or profits. It is much more about total control of the world, and that's how I see it in almost all parts of the world where the West is involved. So there are countries, of course, that are strategically very important in terms of natural resources, Congo, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, but also Iraq and Venezuela. But there are also countries where the West is destabilizing governments strictly on ideological basis.
What follows is a short excerpt from Mr. Volchek's April 3rd talk at the University of Manitoba. It includes a graphic description of extreme misogynistic violence by the West's Rwandan allies. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Pro-Rwanda gangs. It's not that like they just rape her. They are looking for diamonds, so they cut off her vagina and her mouth, face, and she's alive. They don't even bother to kill her because it's like too much work. They just cut everything of hers open while she's dying in agony to look for if she has diamonds on her. It's really horrible there. So that's Rwanda, the great ally of the West.
You've seen a lot of brutality
and obscenities in the course of your travels to, what, 150 countries around the world. Why isn't it enough to just wipe out an alternative economic perspective or secure a strategic resource? Why the barbarity?
Well, I think that what is happening to the Western civilization is cannot be explained anymore by economical or philosophical analysis. I think the West reached the level when only psychiatric treatment could help. I mean, it is suffering from sadistic syndrome, and it does exist, actually. There is a psychiatric definition of that severe sadistic syndrome. I described this in several of my essays, and I'm serious. If you look at least 500 last years of barbarity that the West unleashed against the rest of the world, there can be no other explanation. There are no countries and no parts of the world which would show such mercilessness, such a barbarity as the West, and almost all Western countries. We are talking not only about United Kingdom and France during the colonialist period, not only about Spain, but also about Portugal, also about countries like Netherlands and Belgium and Germany. So basically, I think that a cumulative toll on humanity is close to 1 billion people. And I'm talking about statisticians with whom I worked, top statisticians who calculated before I wrote the book with Noam Chomsky on Western terrorism from Hiroshima to drone warfare. We did some calculations, and it doesn't only include direct slaughter, but of course also diseases, famines that colonialism unleashed. But still, it's close to 1 billion, and that's really, it cannot continue like this. Our planet cannot tolerate one group and one race of people which is acting with such barbarity and such disregard for human suffering. So I saw Western Empire in action on all continents. I heard the stories that people still remember from long ago and also from the recent history. It is terrible world which this Western society had created and imposed on much of the planet. That's why I think that it's very important that things are changing, that people are regrouping, that they are finally understanding what's going on, and opposition is growing. That's why I find the alliance between Russia and China so important. That's why I think that Iran's joining is important. And I also strongly believe that every country which strives for independence and for a better life for its people, and which is antagonized and attacked by the West, each and every country like this, like Syria or Venezuela, should be defended.
What would you say to people who would argue, okay, I hear you on NATO and Western imperialism, but, you know, Russia and China, you know, what business, I mean, maybe they're a threat too. Is there a unique characteristic to the way Russia and China are going about their business elsewhere that's fundamentally different from the United States and Europe? Or is this just, a kind of a clash of two different kinds of empire?
It's definitely not a clash of two empires. It's just what you see Russia and China doing in the rest of the world is defending its allies. It's basically bringing more and more countries to the sphere of which is ready to stand against the only enemy of our planet that we right now have, and it is the West. The biggest nation in the world, in Africa, is Nigeria, where approval rating of China by population is 87%. It's tremendous. And in no African country, this popularity goes below 50%. So in places like Kenya, where I used to live, people are actually demanding that Chinese government and China builds infrastructure, that the money is not given to the local government because there is fear that it will be corrupted. So China is trusted, and so is Russia. You never hear about Russia is a mining and oil giant. You never hear about Russia coming to some country and cleaning it out and overthrowing government there, or throwing people to starvation. Also, China, I was working recently in Laos, China's neighbor. Laos is a country with very few people, and it's as big as Thailand almost. It was bombed, carpet bombed to the ground by the West in sidekick war to Vietnam War. It was called a secret war. Hundreds of thousands of people died. It's still a minefield. Well, China came, and it's building railroads now, the high-speed railroads that will be connecting Laos with the rest of Southeast Asia and China, too. And they're building dams, they're building factories, training centers, everything. Once they come, they pay people the same wages as they pay their own people. A truck driver from Laos makes $1,200 driving truck for Chinese construction company, while the salaries in Laos are, I think, around $50-$60 a month. They treat people the same as they treat their own people. Once they start building this infrastructure, everything goes with it. Schools, hospitals, and community learning centers, trade centers, small businesses, everything. So basically, China is spreading the knowledge, and it is creating enormous amount of jobs. The reaction of the West, instead of competing for hearts and minds of Laotian people, they are supporting absolutely toxic NGOs in Vientiane, the capital, whose purpose is only to basically discredit China. So you see in Vientiane all these weird people driving big four-wheel drives on behalf of the Western governments, and doing nothing else than trying to scare Laotian people and antagonize, to create narrative, powerful narrative against the People's Republic of China.
You identify not as a pacifist or a peacenik, but as a revolutionary. I also note that there is a famous book by Ward Churchill called Pacifism as Pathology. And it makes me wonder about maybe your lament about the West's failure to address the sins of their governments. Do you think there's more to it, those failures, than simply a lack of good information, you know, media brainwashing and so on? Is there a pathology that's interfering with our ability to do the right thing?
Most definitely. I think the Western public is actually co-responsible. It is not only capitalism or Western governments. Every country, including the United States of America, are actually living very high life, and the people in these countries are very privileged compared to other places of the world. So, yes, I fully understand that the United States is underclass. United Kingdom, too, it has many poor people. We cannot deny it. But it's very simple. When I was invited to Italian Parliament 3 years ago, I told them that everything that the European Union has is actually created on destruction and death and plunder. I said I am absolutely against free education and free medical care, if that free education and medical care is only in Europe. As an internationalist, I am for free medical care and free education all over the world. So as they say in Cuba, everybody dances or nobody dances. It is clear to me that people do not want to know. They don't want to get involved. Peace, what they call peace very often, is maintaining the privileges. for their own cultures, for their own countries, for their own continents.
People won't give up their cell phones to stop a Congolese genocide.
Precisely. They never would do anything like that. And they would never say it either. It's all kind of, all assumed. It's all there, but it's never openly described. Because if you would say it openly, then you would actually have to take action, and or other people would take action. So it's all whitewashed. People talk about peace, but what they mean is keeping the status quo, because it's not a peace for the countries that live in absolute misery or that are forced to be occupied. It is peace for people who live in Toronto or Washington or Paris or London. They want peace. Of course, they don't want bombs to fall on them, but on other people, bombs are falling. Or and it can be either concrete bombs or abstract bombs. So it is. There are good people in peace movements. And I saw, for example, in Regina, in Canada, very good group of people, very dedicated group of people, and I'm sure they mean well. But overall obsession in the West with peace is overall obsession with keeping the status quo.
I want to thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with our listeners, and I wish you happy travels and all the best.